You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the November 8th, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. On the day before President Trump kicked off an 11-day swing through the capitals of America's Asia-Pacific allies, promoting a sale of U.S. weapons to Japan and elsewhere, he couldn't resist making another threat against North Korea, which he referred to as the problem, telling Fox News' Laura Ingraham that, quote, if we don't solve it, it's not going to be very pleasant for them. It's not going to be very pleasant for anybody. The peoples in both Koreas and their neighbor Japan are well aware how unpleasant U.S. military can be when it comes to unleashing weapons of mass destruction on those perceived as America's enemies. But real questions remain about the U.S. military's capability to defend itself when one of those enemies threatens to fight back and has the capability of doing so. In a past program, I suggested that the reason that the resident had not ordered U.S. forces to shoot down any of the ballistic missiles that North Korea had launched since the beginning of Trump's war of threats with Kim Jong-un was because of the likelihood they would miss their target. This would be a humiliation on the world stage neither the resident nor the U.S. military could afford to let happen. That's also the conclusion of Phil Giraldi, a veteran of the CIA and a frequent guest on this program, who wrote 2 weeks ago that underlying the American citizenry's willingness to accept that the military establishment could encircle the globe with foreign bases to keep the world, quote-unquote, safe, is the assumption that the 48 states are invulnerable, isolated by broad oceans and friendly nations to the north and south, and protected, Giraldi goes on, from far distant threats by technology interceptor systems developed and maintained at enormous expense to intercept and shoot down incoming ballistic missiles launched by enemies overseas. In a recent speech relating to the North Korean threat, Giraldi notes, President Donald Trump boasted the U.S. anti-missile defenses are 97% effective, meaning that they can intercept and destroy incoming projectiles 97 times out of 100. Trump was seeking to assure the public that whatever happens over in Korea, Giraldi wrote, it cannot have an undesirable outcome over here in the continental United States, nor apparently in Hawaii, Alaska, and overseas possessions like Guam, all of which are shielded under the anti-missile defense umbrella. Trump, wrote Giraldi, was undoubtedly referring to, even if he was ignorant of many of the specifics, the ground-based mid-course defense GMD installations in Alaska and Hawaii, which are part of the existing $330 billion missile defense system. It is certainly comforting to learn that the United States cannot be physically attacked with either nuclear or conventional weapons, no matter what our government asks, does overseas. But is it true, asked Giraldi? What if the countermeasures were somewhat closer to 0% effective? Would that change the thinking about going to war in Korea or about confronting Russia and Eastern Europe? That's what I'll be discussing with Phil Giraldi when I get him on the phone about 20 minutes past the hour, and stay tuned for that. War Secretary James Mattis was already in the region in advance of Trump's trip, repeating the same warnings about North Korea that he had given earlier, by adding that the threat of a nuclear missile attack by North Korea is accelerating. Speaking in Seoul with South Korea Defense Minister Song Yong-moo at his side, Mattis said that regardless of what the North might try, it is overmatched by the firepower and cohesiveness of the decades-old U.S.-South Korean alliance. I cannot imagine a condition under which the United States would accept North Korea as a nuclear power, he said. As could be expected, throughout his week-long Asia trip, which included stops in Thailand and the Philippines, Mattis paid lip service to diplomacy, saying it remains the preferred way to deal with the North. With that said, he added, make no mistake, any attack on the United States or our allies will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons by the North will be met with massive military response that is effective and overwhelming, end quote. Do you recall when the Bush administration first tried to link Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda in 9/11? In order to find another justification besides the non-existent WMDs for the illegal invasion of Iraq? When it wasn't true and those in the White House knew it? Well, it's time we recall the efforts by the pro-Israel neocons of the Project for a New American Century, who orchestrated the invasion and who fabricated the phony evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when the CIA was unable to do so. And why is it time to revisit those unaccounted for and uninvestigated crimes? Because they're at it again. 6 years after the assassination of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan by U.S. Navy SEALs, we are now being told that among the 470,000 documents recovered from his headquarters, there is evidence of collusion between al-Qaeda and Iran. Writing in Bloomberg News on Friday, Eli Lake, a reporter with a well-earned reputation as a pro-Israel insider, wrote that Ryan Trapani, a CIA spokesperson, had told him that, quote, documents collected during the bin Laden raid, which had been declassified, indicate Iran and al-Qaeda have an agreement to not target each other. The documents, wrote Lake, indicate bin Laden referred to Iran as the, quote, main artery for al-Qaeda to move funds, personnel, and communications. And according to the CIA spokesperson, the Obama administration had kept these communications classified. What jumped out at me was Lake's report that Thomas Joslin and Bill Roggio, founders and editors of something called the Long War Journal, were given early access to the latest bin Laden files this week by the CIA. They say the latest information shows two wary rivals willing to cooperate against America. They focus, notes Lake, on a 19-page document allegedly from a senior al-Qaeda operative that gives an early history of the relationship. It began on friendly terms in the late 1990s. They, meaning the Long War Journal's Joslin and Roggio, write that the author of the document, who is not named but appears to be well-connected, quote, explains that Iran offered some Saudi brothers and al-Qaeda everything they needed, including money, arms, and training in Hezbollah camps in Lebanon, in exchange for striking American interests in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, end quote. It's likely that none of you have heard of the Long War Journal, but it happens to be a project of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a successor organization to the Project for New American Century, the pro-Israel neocon tank, the think tank that gave us the Iraq War. The foundation was founded the day after 9/11 as another beltway front for Israel wrapped like PNAC in the Stars and Stripes. If you follow the mainstream media, like I do, including NPR, you'll have heard or seen its executive director, Mark Dubowitz, speak against the nuclear deal with Iran, negotiated by Secretary of State John Kerry and the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. More recently, and none too subtly, he was urging Trump to demand more concessions from Iran before recertifying the agreement as Congress requires a president to do every 90 days. Why, it should be asked, did the CIA provide these newly declassified documents to the Long War Journal, an organ of a pro-Israel propaganda agency where both of its reporters also happen to be senior fellows? The answer may lie with the person who the resident appointed to head the CIA, not a qualified intelligence professional, but a former member of Congress named Mike Pompeo, with a professed affection for Israel and undisguised animus toward Iran. Just 2 weeks ago, by no coincidence, he was the featured speaker at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, where he attacked the Iran deal, and as the Times of Israel described it, Pompeo stressed that Trump wants to ensure the U.S. foe has no pathway to developing the bomb. The notion that the government would, quote, curtail Iranian adventurism or their terror threat or their malignant behavior has now, 2 years on, proven to be fundamentally false, said Pompeo, a former Republican congressman from Kansas, who keenly opposed the Seven-Nation Accord when it was reached, end quote. That's in the Times of Israel, which you can find online in English. Thus, while the U.S. is rattling its swords against North Korea, we may also be watching the beginnings of a countdown to a war with Iran. Washington and Israel's close allies in Saudi Arabia added fuel to that fire by accusing both Iran and Hezbollah of an act of war after a missile fired from besieged Yemen landed in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. Iran, the Saudis said, provided the missile, and Hezbollah, they say, fired it. The Saudis, of course, have been conducting a bloody war on Yemen that has taken the lives of thousands of its people and led to the world's worst cholera epidemic, and they've done it with weapons purchased from the U.S. and with intelligence by the U.S. Air Force. As President Roosevelt once said of Nicaraguan dictator Somoza, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. The U.S. has a stable of them across the globe. This past week has witnessed the 100th anniversary of two of the most significant events of the 20th century. The repercussions of both are still being felt today, but in vastly different ways. The first of them last week was the centenary of the Balfour Declaration, which marked issuing of a letter by Britain's Foreign Secretary, Lord Arthur Balfour, to Lord Walter Rothschild, a scion of the world's dominant banking family, in November 1917, in which the British government authorized the setting up of a national home for the Jewish people in predominantly Muslim Palestine, which was then part of the Ottoman Empire and fighting Britain on the side of the German Kaiser. The second anniversary observed yesterday marked 100 years since the beginning of the Russian Revolution. With Vladimir Putin nowhere in sight, Russian communists, now a distinct minority, were joined by left-wing activists from 88 countries in marching through central Moscow to commemorate the centenary of the overthrow of the Tsar, but it was a pale shadow of the grand Soviet demonstrations that had previously been held in Red Square, as much as Russia, now a nation of wealthy billionaire oligarchs, other than having an all-powerful leader at the top, bears little resemblance to the old Soviet Union. That both events took place in the same month and within days of each other was not, in my estimation, a coincidence, but explaining that would need to be a subject of another program, or two. What I will attempt to point out in brief was why Britain engaged with its European allies in a war with Germany that it was not winning, would think it was so important to offer to Britain's Zionists, a minority within the country's tiny Jewish community, as it was worldwide, a home in Palestine. The evidence points to a simple answer. It was payment to the Zionists for what the British believed was their role in getting President Wilson to break his pre-election promise to the American people not to join the war and then to enter it on the side of Britain, which, it was self-evident, would enable the British to win it. Playing the key role in the matter for the Zionists was Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. He was not only a close friend of Woodrow Wilson's, but the head of the American Zionist movement. The most common explanation for Britain's decision to set up Palestine as a Jewish homeland in face of an understandably hostile Arab resistance is that it was designed to serve Israel's interests in the region, but that comes apart when one examines British Foreign Office documents, particularly during the first 5 years of its mandate. From assuming responsibility for Palestine in the colonial sense, following the armistice to its hasty departure in 1948, Britain's experience in Palestine was nothing but a long headache. It had gotten so bad that by 1923, there was apparently a demand from within the British government that the Balfour Agreement be withdrawn. This led to a telling memorandum by Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire, who had succeeded Winston Churchill as the Secretary of State for the Colonies, which was quoted in Palestine Papers 1917-1922, Seas of Conflict by Doreen Ingrams, published in 1973. Hard to find. Note his careful choice of words. This is the Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire. British policy in Palestine during the past 5 years has been based upon the Balfour Declaration of November 1917. Briefly stated, the object of the declaration was to enlist the sympathies on the Allied side of influential Jews and Jewish organizations all over the world. It is arguable, he went on, that the negotiations with the Zionists, which had been in progress for many months before the declaration was actually published, did in fact have considerable effect in advancing the date in which the United States government intervened in the war. However that may be, it must always be remembered that the declaration was made at a time of extreme peril to the cause of the Allies. The Balfour Declaration was a war measure designed to secure tangible benefits which it was hoped could contribute to the ultimate victory of the Allies. These benefits, said the Duke of Devonshire, may or may not have been worth securing and may or may not have been actually secured. But the objections to going back on a promise made under such conditions are obvious. The Jews would naturally regard it as an act of baseness if, having appealed to them in our hour of peril, we were to throw them over when the danger was past. End quote. Those are the words of Edward Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire, and His Majesty's Secretary of State for the Colonies in 1923. This was largely confirmed by Britain's second wartime Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, in his memoirs. Lloyd George made an additional point by noting that the German Kaiser was also attempting to gain Jewish support. It was believed, also, he wrote, that such a declaration would have a potent influence upon world Jewry outside of Russia and secure for the Entente, that is the Allies, the aid of Jewish financial interest. In America, their aid in this respect would have a special value when the Allies had almost exhausted the gold and marketable securities available for American purchases. Such were the chief considerations which in 1917 impelled the British government towards making a contract with Jewry, end quote. And the rest is history, which we are still dealing with today. So it comes as no surprise that none of what I just read to you has or will be mentioned in the mainstream media's reporting on the Balfour Declaration's 100th birthday. That's because Israel's supporters are unusually effective in keeping what they don't want the public to know from the pages or airwaves of our national media. Another prime example of this occurred just 5 days ago when the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, a tax-exempt American charity, held its annual West Coast fundraiser at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, hosted as usual by the Israeli-American media billionaire Haim Saban and his wife Cheryl, who are well known to have been among Hillary Clinton's major supporters. In a matter of just a few hours, the organization raised $53.8 million, just under $54 million, for the welfare of Israel's Army of Occupation, and as usual after these dinners, other than a brief article in the Hollywood trade publication Variety, there was not a single word of the event in the national media. The top donation announced at the event, and the largest single gift in the Friends of Israel Defense Forces history, was $16.6 million from Oracle co-founder and CEO Larry Ellison. According to its press release, Ellison's $16.6 million donation, all tax exempt, will support the construction of well-being facilities on a new training campus for the Israel Defense Forces co-ed infantry units. One would think this fits the definition of news, but it is more likely that despite issuing a press release to cover their tail, the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces would prefer the public not know what certain members of their community are doing for the soldiers of another nation, while thousands of U.S. veterans, many suffering from PTSD, are homeless in America's streets and committing suicides in double digits every day of the year. It's something to think about, but only you who are listening to Takes on the World and who will listen online will even know about it. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we feature a renegade Israeli journalist and activist, Haggai Matar, who is executive director of a publication company which publishes a magazine in English entitled 972, and a parallel publication published in Hebrew titled Local Call. Both publications are known for their critical coverage of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Haggai has been on tour in the United States and appeared in several venues in the Boston area. This morning you will hear his presentation in Lincoln, Massachusetts. First you will hear his main presentation, followed by an excerpted question and answer period. Here is Haggai Matar of 972 Magazine. 972 are the call numbers used to make an international call to Israel.
Thank you all for coming this afternoon, and thank you, Steve, for that lovely introduction and surprise quote from the book. It was actually part of my testimony in the court-martial, having spent 2 years in prison. That was actually a story I told there to the court as like one of the reasons why I chose to refuse, kind of the earliest stages in the development of my understanding of whether I want to go to the army or not. So that was kind of an understanding, oh, the army is not what they were telling us about. It's not there to protect us. It's there to fight people such as myself, apparently, going on a peaceful convoy. So thank you for that. But I'm here, as Steve said, as the executive director of 972, and I want to talk a little bit about the world of media in Israel. And I want to say two, maybe three basic things. And that's, first, how Israeli media, mainstream media in Israel, is not an ally of the progressive camp. It is not an ally of anyone supporting a peaceful solution, an end to the occupation, social justice, decent foreign policy. All those things are not something that you can find in mainstream media in Israel. The second thing that I want to talk about is how, in spite of this, in the past few years, the government and others around its closest supporters have been waging an attack on mainstream media, in spite of it being fairly supportive of the occupation, and I want to say a little bit why. And the third thing is how, I think, alternative media, such as 972 Magazine and Local Call, which we publish, can offer an answer to both the problems and the faults of mainstream media and the attacks by the government, and how this is connected with things that are happening globally and here in the U.S. So to start, I first realized the problems of the mainstream media in Israel already as an activist when I was 16 and 17, later refused and went to prison. And after that, as I became very involved in demonstrations, the popular demonstrations against the wall and settlements in villages such as Bil'in and Ma'asara and Abisalach and others. And I would go to these demonstrations as an activist, a young activist, and I would see the huge gap between what was happening on the ground and what was being reported in mainstream media. And it was a painful gap. And it was thus for in two different ways. Like, one way would be for the media to just ignore demonstrations if they were completely nonviolent, if they were there were no stones thrown and no army, no clashes with the army or anything like that, just masses of people marching and peacefully resisting land grabs and settlement construction of the wall, then that would never be reported. And when there were confrontations, they would always be portrayed as though the Palestinians are responsible. And this is even the most extreme cases, perhaps, when I went to this one demonstration in Bil'in once, and the organizers wanted, they know that at some point in the demonstration, people start throwing stones and the army shoots tear gas, but they wanted the first phase of this specific demonstration, which was unusually large, to be completely nonviolent. And as people were marching, a few people started throwing stones. And the organizers went to them and told them, look, we don't want this for this phase. We're trying to have a nonviolent protest. And the people throwing stones took out badges, and it was apparent that they were soldiers undercover as demonstrators, throwing stones to create a media image of the protesters starting the violence vis-a-vis the army. And they started arresting the people trying to stop them from throwing stones from within the protest at the other soldiers. And you know, this was a crazy thing to see. But then I got back home and I saw how the media was reporting it, and once again it was like this riot in Bilin, Palestinian violent terrorists and their international or local Israeli allies attacked soldiers and so on and so on. And this has no room for what happened to be reported in mainstream media. And this is even when they do report. And like I said before, the nonviolence resistance is never reported. And even more than that, just the day-to-day lives, what people experience as life under occupation, what it means to go through checkpoints or to suffer from administrative detention without trial, or the day-to-day meaning of living under occupation is something that you just don't find in mainstream Israeli media. The same goes to a lesser degree toward 48 Palestinians with Israeli citizenship that live inside the Green Line, but also their stories are not reported enough in mainstream media. And this reality that I recognized first as an activist was one of the things that drew me into becoming a journalist. I thought then I would go there, I would be part of the system, and I would change it. I would start reporting these things that aren't reported elsewhere. And I became, in the beginning, a municipal correspondent in Tel Aviv. I was reporting for one of the biggest newspapers called Ma'ariv. And very early on in my job there, I remember going to my editor and pitching a story which I had learned about. This was a family living in Jaffa, so it's in my turf. They were about to be evicted from their public housing apartment, and the two parents were suffering from disabilities. So I thought, this is something that we should report on. If the city is kicking out people from their home, and it's part of a gentrifying process in Jaffa, it's something to talk about. And my editor was very quick to ask me, are they Jewish or are they Arab? And I said, well, they're Arab. They just happen to be Arab. She said, okay, so that's not a story, she said. We can't report that. Our readers don't want to read that stuff. And it was so blunt. It was so, she wasn't even trying to go around this question. And I was actually quite shocked. And I would later find out that this wasn't a one-time case. It was time and time again that stories were ruled upon and decided whether or not we publish according to the identity of the people whose stories are being told. They're citizens. They suffer from the same ills of the system. But if they're Arab, their stories aren't told. Over time, I became a member of the board of the Journalist Union in Israel. As a union, we've been organizing meetings of journalists to talk about our different experiences, either labor issues or other freedom of information, freedom of press issues. And one of the things that came up was that 9 out of 10 journalists that I had spoken to in events have gone through the exact same experience in their very different desks, newspapers, radio, television, internet. 9 out of 10 journalists had experienced going to an editor saying, I have this story, someone was wronged, someone was injured, someone is being mistreated for some reason, and if they're Arab, that's not a story. The thing is, it's very scientific. I once spoke to a senior analyst on Channel 2 News. This is the most prominent, by far, most prominent television news show. And he told me that they follow the ratings that they have, and they know that any story that includes Arabs, the ratings drop. So they have very, very high ratings, and they drop, and people zip away, and then come back when the story is over. So for them, being driven by profit, obviously, they can't afford having too many stories about Arabs, about Palestinians, if it's not the utmost importance, which is violence, terrorism, security issues, stories that also reaffirm what the viewers already think of Palestinians, so they would stay. But if they hear a story about Palestinians being mistreated, then that's kind of a turnoff for viewers. So they just don't do it if they don't have to. So this is a brief description of the ills of mainstream media's treatment of Palestinians. At the same time, as I was saying before, in recent years we've been seeing an attack by the government against the media, something that might seem not too unfamiliar for Americans over the past year. But we've had this going for quite a long time. It started around 2009. We started seeing a process since the Gaza War, the first of three Gaza War, wars in 2009, we started seeing a process wherein the government is starting to become more and more authoritarian towards Israeli Jews within Israel. And this process that we've been seeing in attacking any institution that symbolizes democratic thought, liberal thought, not towards Palestinians, again, only towards the Jewish residents and citizens of Israel, is coming under attack. And this includes the judicial system, civil society organizations, the media, the academic world, and others. Just last week, in the opening of the winter session in Knesset, President Ruvi Rivlin, who is the official head of state, doesn't have any power, but the head of state there, said that he fears the government is performing a coup against all other democratic institutions in the country. So, and this is him saying this after 8 years of an ongoing process by the government. And what we've been seeing, and here I should say there's a split between the government's attacks on Palestinian media and journalists and Israeli journalists. There's quite a difference. With the first, what we see and have been seeing throughout the occupation is media outlets being shut down with a military warrant and no explanation. Just 2 weeks ago, 8 of them were shut down by a military warrant in the West Bank. Journalists can be arrested and detained without trial or charge for what they call administrative detention, and this can go on for months on end. Journalists can be shot at or beaten, and all sorts of things. So that's for Palestinian journalists. Israeli journalists do not suffer the same treatment. It's not as bad as that. But we have been seeing, this is the escalation of recent years, we have been seeing more and more attacks that they would start with incitement by Netanyahu, not unlike Trump, kind of pointing the finger either generally at the media or specific journalists or specific media outlets, saying they're foreign agents, they are lying to you, they're hiding all the great things that my government is doing, they are allies of the New Israel Fund and the extreme left, and therefore are not to be trusted. So kind of this ongoing incitement. And at the same time, what we've been seeing is new regulations by police, just enforced as of 3 weeks ago, limiting the access of journalists to cover demonstrations. So now policemen can decide that the presence of journalists is a cause for violence in a demonstration. The existence of someone there documenting is creating the violence, so it's best to drive away the journalists first and then deal with the demonstrators. So this is fairly new. It's being challenged by the Journalists Union and ACRI, which is the ACLU in Israel. It's being challenged in the Supreme Court, this new policy, but it is part of what's been going on. We've been seeing a rise in the intervention of the military censorship with stories. 1 in 5 stories filed with the military censor, and you have to file all stories security or foreign relations have to be filed in advance with the military censor. And 1 in 5 stories is being intervened with. Most aren't deleted, but they would ask you to change something, to remove something, and you're not allowed to say or even indicate that the censor has intervened with this story. We can't like leave a blank or just note, you know, something has been dropped here. So we've seen a rise in the censors' intervention recently, also with Facebook pages. They started for the first time approaching operators of Facebook pages, saying you too, not only mainstream media, have to go through us. And we've been seeing a rise in gag orders issued by the courts. There are 3 times more gag orders the past year than there have been 15 years ago, and there's a constant rise of 20% per year the past 3 years. So all these things have been happening, while also Netanyahu is trying to pass several different kinds of new regulations limiting the freedom of the press. And all these things have been happening. And while the media, mainstream media, is concerned about this, they're not really fighting it so far. With the union and some of the alternative media trying to combat these measures, but mainstream media is, so far, most outlets are just taking care of themselves. And what I want to say is what we can do as an alternative media outlet. As Steve was saying before, we run 972 magazine. It's a blogger-based, volunteer-based journalistic outlet that we've been publishing for a little over 7 years now. It's based on Israeli and Palestinian journalists and bloggers and photographers throughout the land reporting, and few editors that are professional journalist editors that edit, proof, fact-check, and publish the stories. And what we can, and we have the parallel site, which is Local Call in Hebrew. And what we can do with these things is try to challenge both the downsides of the media and the attacks by the government. I'll just give you two examples. One is a story that happened this January 18th, in the village of Umm al-Khiran in the Negev. This is a Bedouin village considered unrecognized by the government, which means that even though the people there have been living there for dozens of years and actually settled there by the government many years ago, it's not legal. And the government recently decided that this village would be destroyed and replaced with a Jewish settlement. Again, this is Israeli citizens in the Negev, not the West Bank. And on January 18th, a mass police force arrived with bulldozers to start destroying homes. One of the residents of the village got into a car and started driving away, and police opened fire and killed this person in his car. The car then lost control and hit a policeman, killing him as well. The police had to put a siege around the village so that reporters hearing about this development could not come in. And at the same time, police was releasing statements that an Islamic terrorist has committed a ramming attack against a policeman, killing him and then thus forcing police to open fire and killing the terrorist as well. All media outlets in Israel publish this story as is, not like police is saying that. An ISIS attacker, they even said that he was probably connected with ISIS. So like an ISIS attacker killing a policeman in Umm al-Khiran. We were the only media outlets to have had people in the village from the night before, so we weren't affected by the siege. We thought that this destruction of the village is a big story, even without the bloodshed, just the fact that the village is being destroyed. So we made sure we'll be there ahead of time. And we were able, while on the scene, to get eyewitness testimonies from people that saw the shooting and were able to testify that the person was driving away, that he was shot at for no reason. And within hours, by publishing these testimonies on our sites, we changed the discourse in the entire Israeli media. Within hours, other media outlets had to retract their initial statements, to change their headlines, to embed the videos that we had of people testifying about what they had seen, and retell the story. So they might have had questions. They might have said, there are two versions to the story. We don't know what's truth yet. And with time, they found out that we were right all along. But still, they had to change their initial statements. So by just being on the ground in places that usually the media doesn't think matter, and by just being there and reporting the truth and making sure that we can document it with videos, with documents, with footage, we can make a difference in how mainstream media is reporting. The second thing we can do is challenge the attacks on the media. For many, many years, unfortunately, the journalist union was not concerned with the attacks of the government against Palestinian journalists. So when journalists were put in administrative detention, the journalist union just didn't take any action. The coverage in 972 magazine and Local Call has gradually forced the union to take a stand, because we would approach, and I'm in two hats here because I'm both in these sites and a member of the board, which was in a minority there, but we would approach the union for a comment, why aren't you doing something about this latest administrative tension of, for example, a board member in the Palestinian union that's a colleague of yours? Why are you not doing anything about this? And eventually, after about a year and a half of pressure, just this year, a few months ago, for the first time, the journalist union decided to take action and oppose detention of Palestinian journalists. So we are making a difference. And the last thing I want to say before opening this up for questions, it's a small room so we can have a lively debate, I hope, is that these issues that we are facing and dealing with, I think both with media, but even more so with the government, are not an isolated Israeli story. They're part of a global trend. They're part of a global development of authoritarian or quasi-authoritarian regimes on the rise here in the U.S. and in Eastern Europe and Turkey and Russia and Israel. And these regimes and these leaders, they're connected with each other. They learn from each other. They operate together. They act locally but think globally. They recognize the similarities of their opponents and of their own goals. We can see this with the people leading these different kinds of processes. For example, Sheldon Adelson, a prominent Republican supporter here, millionaire and casino mogul that has casinos from Macau to Las Vegas, supports Republican candidates here and the Republican cause here, owns media outlets here in the U.S., and owns the number one most widely spread and read newspaper in Israel that is a patron of Netanyahu, called Israel Hayom. And it's a free paper. It's given out free throughout the country. And in several years, it has become the number one most read newspaper just because they're giving out free throughout the country. So these people, and Breitbart, for example, Andrew Breitbart, I don't know how many people know this, but he thought of setting up a site to challenge mainstream media from the right when he was in Jerusalem. The first time he had thought about this, he was in Jerusalem, and he said to a bunch of friends, and this is in a book about his legacy, he talked to his friends and said, we need to set up a site to counter the J Street pro-Palestinian lies in the media, and so we can start with that. So these people, they recognize the similarities and how they're leading a joint struggle. And the reason that I'm here is to say that we should perhaps be thinking the same. We should be recognizing that we are leading the same struggles here in Israel, Palestine, and many other places. So supporting the cause of Israelis and Palestinians resisting the occupation and resisting the authoritarian trends of our government is not kind of, you know, supporting a distant cause out of charity. It is thinking politically about one struggle that is becoming global. That's it.
Thank you. Yes, to tag on to know about similar struggles, a lot of us are frustrated too that our media doesn't talk about these things. Mm-hmm. How receptive or not have you found American media to your message?
That varies, really. I think on a whole, American media is hard. A hard nut to crack for us. I am happy to say that we know that journalists covering our region read 972 magazine regularly, and not just journalists, like politicians, diplomats. If you look at the Clinton letters, you can see several links to 972 magazine, so we know Hillary was reading or at least being sent links to 972 magazine. So we know we have an influence that goes beyond, you know, the kind of immediate choir, if you will, that follow us. And we see this effect as sometimes our stories would be picked up by mainstream media. And the same kind of thing I was telling you about Israeli media picking up our story on Umm al-Khiran and changing its narrative, we have been seeing, not with all American media, but definitely with the New York Times, would often quote either directly or indirectly stories that we've had, and you could see the discourse changing, and we're trying to be in touch with reporters in The Nation and Washington Post and New York Times and others to kind of offer them a different framework to understand what is happening in our region.
So there's some progress?
There is. It's gradual, but it's happening, yes.
Are the journalists who write for 972 employees of 972, or are they freelancers who submit stories? And how do you position people? You said you got someone to that village in the negative the night before because you knew things were going to happen. How easy it is to place people where they need to be to get the story?
So the way that the two sites are built is kind of a bottom-up system of volunteer journalists. So each site only has two editors that are staff, basically, like 2.5 for local call. So that are staff that are working on the site. All the others are volunteers. And how we do this is just by having people that are politically active or involved or just deeply care about stories, and because it's bottom-up reporting, it's not unlike regular stories. It's not that you would have an editor saying someone has to go and commission or send someone out to the field, but you'd have a WhatsApp group of all the volunteers for both sites just saying, okay, there's a demolition tomorrow morning, does anyone want to go? And someone would say, yes, of course, I'm already on my way because I was invited by the people there, or because I live nearby and I'm part of the struggle, and we'll just go there. If we can't get anyone to volunteer, then we try to rely on other sources, we try calling people and seeing. Actually, right now, for the first time next year, 2018, is going to be the first year that we are starting to grow our operations, and for the first time we will be starting to commission stories. It's after 7 years we feel that we have kind of reached the maximum potential of the volunteer model. So for the first time, this obviously means an increase in our budget, we will start paying and commissioning stories that we feel are missing and are important.
Can you comment on the push to shut down Al Jazeera now?
Mm-hmm. Like here in Israel and... Yeah, I think it's terrible. I mean, it's part of that ongoing attack that I've been mentioning. Of course, it has different levels. So yes, in Israel, for example, they're trying to revoke the press cards for Al Jazeera. They're trying to shut down their offices. It's very complicated because there are still laws in place that don't really allow the government to do whatever it pleases. So it's an ongoing battle there. I think it's dangerous, and the union is very much involved in this. The first Al Jazeera correspondent that was told that he would lose his official press card appealed the decision, and the union represented him, and the decision was overturned. So, but it's an ongoing battle. Like the week after that, the government press office, which issues press cards, had this kind of convention to discuss freedom of speech in the case of Al Jazeera. And they wanted the head of Al Jazeera to be there and speak about freedom of speech and freedom of press. And then they were told by the Prime Minister's office, that is like above, they're part of the Prime Minister's office, that they can't have him speak in this debate on freedom of press. So they canceled the invite, and they had a Jewish-only panel of people speaking against Al Jazeera in this debate about the case of Al Jazeera, which is, you know, just obnoxious, I think. But yeah. But I think legally we have tools to protect them.
Several weeks ago, maybe months ago, there was talk that Netanyahu and his wife were going to be indicted any minute.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
His wife is probably being indicted. That's imminent. I don't know, like, you know, could be a few more weeks, but it's happening. And Netanyahu himself is not as close to that right now. There are several criminal investigations. At least one of them is likely to lead to an indictment, but that would take... It'll take a while. Like, the police has to reach its conclusion, then make a recommendation to the general attorney, and then he has a hearing, and you know, it can go on forever.
If he's indicted, will the government fall? Will there be
no
elections?
Now, he already said that even if indicted, he doesn't think himself that he should step down. And there's a legal question on that. It's actually legally unclear whether or not he has to step down. In the past, when prime ministers were indicted, they just chose to step down. As he already said this, if he is indicted and he doesn't step down, someone will probably go to the Supreme Court and say that he has to, and it will be an interesting precedent case on that. So there's always a fear, though, that he would try and have either earlier elections, a war, or both, to kind of shift attention away. That's the one thing everybody's like most scared of, that to shift attention away from corruption charges, he would turn to very incitementful election campaign, or a war, or both.
I admire your position on the military experience. How did you survive those 2 years, and was your envisionment people who are Palestinian were enemies of Israelis?
No. I spent part of my time in military prison, so that's only for soldiers, basically. And then at some point I was transferred to civilian prison, but in the civilian prison system, there's like segregation between Israeli citizens, Jewish and Palestinian, and non-citizens, so Palestinians from the occupied territories. So they have different conditions, they're in different areas. So I actually had a friend of mine, a Palestinian friend of mine, that we were in the same prison, but in different wards. So we would correspond by, I would send like a letter out to my family, they would give it to his family that would then come to visit him, like, you know, literally like across the wall from me and give him that letter, and vice versa. And in terms of surviving it, I mean, you know, it was difficult. It wasn't violent or brutal, or, you know, it wasn't dangerous in any way. It was just a difficult experience. I mean, prison is a very, very difficult place to be in. I think looking back at it, being young was also challenging experience, being the youngest in prison, civilian prison. But I think I just went through it first because, you know, we don't really have a choice. So I didn't expect going to 2 years. Most conscientious objectors usually go to prison for a term of between 2 to 4, maybe 5 months. So that was what I had expected. I actually had plans. I had like plans for what I'm going to do right after. And then at the time, this was 2002, it was the height of the Second Intifada, and there was a wave of conscientious objection, and suddenly dozens of people were refusing at the same time. And the army recognized that as a threat, whereas they would usually have up to like 5 people in prison. Suddenly they had 40 at a time, at any given moment. So they singled out a few of us that they identified as like prominent activists in the movement and court-martialed us. And then it suddenly became this massive thing in 2 years. But what kept me going, aside from the fact that I just had to because I was there, was knowing that this is actually having an impact, that our trial was getting massive coverage in the media. It was talked about, it was discussed both locally and internationally. It was a big thing, and we were receiving, you know, bags full of letters of support from people worldwide, from Palestinians, saying, you know, we gave up on the Israeli society, but then we heard that you people are refusing, and, you know, that's a ray of sunlight for us. So for us, that was, you know, an inspiration and a reason to keep going.
If you refuse to join the army, how could you be court-martialed? Don't you have to be in the army to be court-martialed?
It's actually a technicality. When the day comes, when your draft date comes, you don't have to do anything to become part of the army. You're automatically drafted. You're transferred. This is how it happens. You're transferred from the computers of the Ministry of Interior to the Ministry of Defense. You become a soldier, and then you're actually sentenced not for refusing the draft, but for disobeying the order of becoming a soldier. That was the actual letter of the law that I was sentenced for, disobeying the order of becoming a soldier.
Could you speak to the migration issue of especially the younger people leaving Israel, and then the immigration issue of the more conservative people going to Israel? Can you speak to the notion of what's happening?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't have exact numbers. To the best of my knowledge, there's not a significant rise in immigration to Israel. Sometimes there would be a bit of a wave, but that, like, if you look at over the years, there isn't a massive trend right now or anything like that that's happening. With people leaving, that's a different case. Many people are leaving to all sorts of places for all sorts of reasons. The U.S., Berlin, and Russia are like the three most popular destinations. For Russia, it's mainly people that emigrated and are just giving up and going back, usually because they feel rejected by the Israeli society, they feel they can't integrate. And the others are people I think some people, not many, leave for political reasons, just giving up on society and saying, you know, there's no way to fight here, or feeling, I mean, it's a rough place to live in, and you want peace and quiet. I mean, I'm actually staying with a friend that left the country and lives here in Boston, and welcome, actually, and I'm staying with her, and, she, you know, she's still a political activist here on the same issues, but, you know, I can see her day-to-day life in the beautiful foliage and, you know, the trees and the serene views and the nice people of Greater Boston. And I, you know, I really, really can understand, and it really, really makes sense to live here and not go through the ongoing day-to-day struggles there. But the number one reason for people leaving, and I have met people, I stayed in New York before with other friends that came here, and are saying that it's just pure economic reasons. The price of living in Israel is extremely high, salaries are low, everything costs a fortune, housing, basic utilities, everything costs so much that it's very, very hard just to make a living and support a family. So people just leave because of that. And I've been speaking to so many Israelis here that just tell me, you know, I miss home and I want to go back, but I can't make it economically. I can't afford living home.
I have two questions. I'll ask them. I'd like to answer the first one first, then I'll ask the second question.
Okay.
The first question is that here in the U.S., we've provided for decades now unqualified and critical support for the government of Israel and its policies. To some degree, many of us believe that this is driven to a large degree by politics, mm-hmm. and particularly at the national level by AIPAC, and perhaps at the more local or state levels by Jewish federations. We're fighting in Massachusetts right now anti-BDS legislation. Mm-hmm. The Federation obviously is supporting it, that they wrote the bill. So the question that I have for you is, what would you tell the American Jewish community if you could address the American Jewish community? And by that I mean the whole community, not just the left side of the community, but the right side. What would you tell the American Jewish community about what this country could be doing or should be doing to help resolve this issue?
I'm not sure I would have the same message for the left and for the right here, but generally speaking, I would go back to saying that we have to recognize, and I think not enough people recognize, the choice that Israeli governments, consecutive governments, for many, many years now, have been making in Israel to maintain the occupation and the status quo, as I was saying before. I mean, that is like the one thing that I often find people don't understand. People say Israel is offering its hand in peace, it's looking for ways. Nobody is doing that. I mean, Netanyahu is very, very clear about, I'm not going to take down any, well, not a single settlement. He just said this recently. There's no negotiations happening. The head of the opposition, Avi Gabay, recently said, I too am not going to take down any settlement. And not to say that he wants to, either of them want a one-state solution with the settlements or anything. Just, you know, there's not going to be any agreement. And Yair Lapid, the third contester for government, also says there will be no agreement. There will be no dismantling of settlements. The occupation will not end. All of the possible runner-ups for Prime Minister in the near future are basically saying there will not be peace. And we will not negotiate, or maybe we'll negotiate because it looks good, but we'll not sign a peace agreement. And people have to understand that. So then you can say, people can make a choice. They can say, okay, we don't care. We support Israel if it's an occupying power. We support Israel if it violates human rights. If you want to do that, then, you know, fine. Keep on going with the way you have been. You know, it's been working. So, you know, you can go on. But if you do support any kind of peaceful solution, if you do think that the occupation is a moral wrong and that the future even of Jewish Israelis in that land is something that is supposed to last for the long run, then the answer has to be ending the occupation in peace. And for that, something dramatic has to change, because the status quo can go on for a very, very, very long time, as we have seen. We're not in point of you know, assuming what might happen. This is like 50 years since the 67 occupation, and even more than that with discrimination within Israel. So this has been going for a very, very long time. If you want to change that, something has to change. It's not going to come from within Israel, unless something very, very surprising happens, but it probably won't. So there are only two other factors at play here that can make a difference. One is a massive Palestinian uprising that right now I do not see in the cards. This is not any way clear. Of course, these things happen sometimes out of the blue, as we've seen. You know, 2011 taught us a lesson in predicting what kind of revolutions might or might not happen. But still, right now it seems that this is not something that's going to happen. Israeli public opinion is not going to change. So the third option is international pressure. So if you want something to change, you need to start utilizing pressure. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in the exact same position. That was one.
That's okay. So that plays into my second question.
Right.
Is would you care to comment on the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, and the role that might play?
Yeah, sure. So I think BDS is a good example of such possible pressure. I should say this is not like, and many other things I've been saying here, is not like an official position of 972s, also because that would be illegal in Israel. But even besides that, our position is against the occupation without supporting any specific solution or tool. But personally, I think BDS is a non-violent tool and a useful tool in pressuring Israel. So I do think that's important and it's something that can be used. Yeah.
Do you think it's having any effect on...
I don't think so. I mean, the one thing that it's been doing so far, and this is... It's not gotten to the point yet where it's actually having an effect where people say, okay, we have to choose, like, you know, commerce with the world or occupation. I mean, we're not at that point. It's become this thing that the government would often use as a tool to incite against civil society, kind of pointing fingers and saying they're working with someone, that works with someone, that has once said something supportive of BDS, so, you know, boycott them. So it's kind of helping the government right now to kind of single out political activists. So right now that's bad, of course, but I do think that in the long run it might have a better effect if it's, you know, a stronger movement.
So that's interesting. What I think I hear you saying is that Israel doesn't use boycott. They suggest that people boycott what they don't agree with. So there is something within Israel that agrees with the boycott as long as...
It's the right boycott. Yeah, as long as it's the right boycott.
So they agree with that.
Yeah, it's a political tool.
Right.
It's a political tool.
Yeah.
So
I think that's an interesting thing to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you can see the government itself is, as part of its attack on different democratic institutions, for the past year or even more, is starting to take away funds from all sorts of, mainly in the world of culture, theaters, film productions, and so on, if they do anything that he doesn't like. So that is sort of a boycott by the government. I mean, the government is responsible for sponsoring theaters in Israel. It's by law. They have to support theaters, but they changed the law so they can remove support for anything that is supportive of terror. And the definition of supportive terror is very, very, very wide. So, for example, just recently, there's a Palestinian poet that is under arrest, was detained in prison for, I think, 9 months, and since then, 9 more months has been in house arrest for a poem that she published on Facebook. And there was an evening of solidarity with her in a theater in Jaffa. And just for being in solidarity with the poet that published a poem that the government finds offensive, that theater might now lose It's public support. It's government support. So, and there are and others that are organizing to be in support of that theater might also lose their funding. So this is kind of this ongoing process where the government is, as you say, boycotting in a way itself.
You have been listening to Israeli journalist and activist Haggai Matar of 972 Magazine speaking at the Lincoln Library. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we discuss a new book. It's titled White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We're joined for the hour by Dr. Carol Anderson, a professor and chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University. And here is Peter to introduce Dr. Anderson to you. Peter?
Dr. Carol Anderson is the Samuel Chandler Dobbs Professor and chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University. She's the author of many books and articles, including Bourgeois Radicals, the NAACP and the Struggle for Colonial Liberation, 1941 to 1960, The Eyes of the Prize, the United Nations and the African American Struggle for Human Rights. You've written a number of historical things. Carol, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
I've really enjoyed reading through this book, White Rage, and it's really about how whites harbor, often perhaps even unconsciously, fears of black progress, and that that manifests itself in a variety of ways. Could you talk about that, your overall thesis?
Yeah, my overall thesis is that when African Americans advance, and that advancement is toward getting access to their inherent citizenship rights and to their inherent human rights, when they make those advancements, such as moving from property to human being after the Civil War, you see a range of policy initiatives just emanating out of government bureaucracies that are designed to undercut that advancement. We see it after the Civil War. We see it during the Great Migration, the Brown Decision, the Civil Rights Movement, which we often heralded as this wonderful achievement when the United States became the United States, where it really lived up to its billing, what it said it was, what it said it was designed to do. But then how do you explain where we are now? And so I look at those moments of advancement and then go through systematically through the policies that rose up, in fact, to undercut that achievement.
Carol Anderson, you're talking about cycles in the book, historical cycles, and you're mentioning that there is this sense of two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back in some ways. And you highlight then that this is a consistent theme historically. What led you to the title, White Rage? What are you capturing, do you think, historically with the title of your work?
I'll talk about what got me there and then move backwards, because this is what historians do. What got me there, I was watching the news cycle when Ferguson was on fire after the killing of Michael Brown, and more importantly, after his body was just left there for hours on the ground in August as a signal to the community. And I'm watching the fires just erupt, and the pundits and the newscasters were all describing this black rage. Black people burning up where they live. Why are black people burning up where they live? And they had these very narrowed arguments for why black people were burning up where they live. And as they're talking about this, I found myself shaking my head. No, they've just missed it. What we're really looking at is not black rage, but white rage. And then that's those moments of epiphany that one has, right? And I had lived in Missouri for about 13 years. I used to teach at the University of Missouri. And I saw what public policy did in that state. And I began to think through how, in these moments of what looks like advancement, in fact, we have policies that undercut it. And policies that actually erode the vibrancy of American democracy. They erode the vibrancy of what the United States could be, its potential. And that's how I came to white rage. That and it's also to make it clear that it's not what we often think of as rage in terms of like the Klan burning a cross or throwing the N-word around or anything like that. This is the kind of rage that moves very coolly, very methodically, very systematically, and it often cloaks itself in this beautiful patriotic language of, say, protecting the integrity of the ballot box, of ensuring the sanctity of neighborhood schools.
Carol Anderson, I just wanted to interject momentarily because you yourself in your book, White Rage, you put it so well when you talked about buzzwords, dog whistles, and sophistry. That was one of my favorite lines there. But that's what you're describing here.
Yes, yes. And, you know, you think about it, how many times have we heard those kind of dog whistles? The dog whistles of, you know, we have to have law and order. Who could be against law and order? Right? So it sounds so, oh.
Who could possibly oppose it, right?
Yeah, who could possibly oppose it? Except when you pull back the veneer, and that's really what I've worked on doing in this, is pulling back the veneer so we can see historically how this thing works over time. And what you have, because it's also going after several of the myths. So the myths that, well, you know, either Lincoln freed the slaves, so I don't know why black people can't make it, or that it was all over, all of the discrimination was over by the time of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. I don't know why black people can't make it. Well, what you see here are African Americans, despite all of the odds, pushing forward with incredible resilience and being punished for that resilience. So think about it. You have children who are fighting to get an education. This is what we say we want and value in this society, right? We want kids who love to learn. You have children fighting to get an education, and you then have governors and legislatures shutting down their public schools. Wow. That's white rage.
Carol, you trace historically this white rage and how it manifests itself over 200 years and probably even before that. But, I mean, you start after the Civil War. You talk about the black codes that were implemented in many states around the country, even after Emancipation Proclamation. You talk about the history of Lincoln, even trying to get blacks to move to Panama and other places in the world to separate out. So those histories come right up to the present. They come right up to the current candidacy saying, take back America, which certainly is coded for white people take back America. Is that how you see it?
It is so ahistorical. You know, there's a candidate for Congress in Tennessee just put up a billboard, Make America White Again, right? And I want to say, again?
Yeah, indeed.
Sorry, but there were some folks here before you, right? But it's part of a powerful narrative that is driving the current impulse to, quote unquote, make America great again. That's driving the take back our country movement. This kind of sense of an incredible loss against the maddening hordes or something. And I really believe that what is so important is that we get our history right, that we really understand what happened and why. Now, there are some folks that you can't convince. That's just the nature of this beast. But there are those who just don't know, and that we've got to make it clear how this came to be. Why don't schools function? Why do our cities look the way they look? Why are we looking at state budgets that are cracking under the weight of mass incarceration, when in fact we know that a better investment would be actually in education, would be in providing really decent health care. So something is going on. And so this book looks at those kinds of priorities as a society that we are setting, that we have a choice to make. And when we make the right ones, things are good. We allow white rage to work. It goes off the rails.
Kara, the term white rage, certainly for people who harbor overt racism, they're just going to say, that just doesn't make sense.
Right.
But what I like to call liberal ostriches, who really say, oh, I'm not racist, and don't have any understanding of the depth and the history that they're immersed in, that they grew up in, and how that manifests itself even today. To get some of the history here. The Black Codes, why were those needed after the Civil War?
So the Black Codes were needed because now you have African Americans who had been seen legally as property, now being human beings, and human beings who are demanding their citizenship rights. And so here you have an incredible advancement. And those citizenship rights include the right to vote. And the Black Codes were designed to basically reinscribe slavery by another name. So what they did was, and they, states like Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, what they did was they passed legislation that said, if you were black, and because understand that the Black Codes were for black people only, if you were black, you had to prove that you had a job. If you did not have proof of employment, you either had to sign a labor contract that would last a year, and you couldn't leave that employer regardless of wages, regardless of how poorly you were treated, regardless if the plantation owner was whipping you, or you would be a vagrant and arrested by the criminal justice system, right? And put through that criminal justice system where your labor would then be auctioned off to a plantation owner, to a lumber mill owner, to a mine owner. And you would then have to work off what they had paid to get you out of jail. Whatever it did, whatever your status was, it meant that your labor was owned by somebody else and you had no right to take that labor anywhere. I mean, you want to talk about undermining the capitalist system?
This is indentured servitude.
Yes, it is. This was law after law after law. You're just watching these Black Codes erupt across the Old South, the post-Civil War South, as a way to dragoon black labor into rebuilding the South, but not having to pay for it.
And Carol Anderson, add to that, of course, the literacy tests and the so-called grandfather clause.
Yes.
The assaults were numerous and coming from multiple angles, generated from really a generation of racist white former slave owners that were legislators.
Yes, and you really see the rise of these because in there's that fluid moment where black people are fighting back. They're building their own schools. You've got federal troops there after Andrew Johnson has to go away.
Well, that early Reconstruction period, there's a lot of positive changes.
There were a lot of positive changes during the radical Republican Reconstruction. During the presidential Reconstruction days with Andrew Johnson, not so good.
No, and Grant, and you're right, and then up to the Hayes Compromise, not much of a compromise for African Americans, that's for sure. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson. Her new book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We'll continue the conversation with Carol Anderson after this brief musical break. Please stay with us.
Said, hey, little boy, you can't go where the others go. You don't look like they do. Said, hey, old man, how can you stand to think that way? Did you really think about it before you made the rules? He said, that's just the way it is. Some things will never change.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're speaking with Professor Carol Anderson. Her latest book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Before the break, Carol Anderson, we were starting to get into the black codes and some of the many challenges, institutional challenges, let's call them what they were, institutionally racist statutes that birthed what later becomes known as Jim Crow. And we know that those were segregation laws that eventually lead to the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896. Can you walk us up through this period? Because there's this brief window after the Civil War where there's hope. There are some things that are changing. But then, as you illustrated before the break, this shuts down through Andrew Johnson and then through the Hayes presidency, certainly the train wreck of a Grant presidency. Take us here through what becomes one of the most significant impediments for African-American equality via Jim Crow.
So there you have, because the Supreme Court during that era has issued a series of rulings that undercut Congress's intent on ending slavery, the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment, saying you are a citizen if you are born in the United States, and which also outlines due process, and the 15th Amendment, the right to vote.
For African-American men.
Yes. And so the U.S. Supreme Court systematically went through each one of those and said, no, that's not what that means. So you get that the 14th Amendment is really not about citizenship rights, but it is about the rights of corporations as people. That's where the due process lies. And that what it also means is that any kind of civil right that you think you have has to be handled by the state. It is the state that has the authority over civil rights. Now, what that means is you're putting civil rights in the hands of Mississippi, in the hands of Alabama. You're putting the civil rights in the hands of folks who in their constitutional conventions have said, this is a government made for the white race, to the benefit of the white race, and those of African descent have no rights. That's what the Supreme Court did. So by the time we get to the 1890s, we're looking at a series of Supreme Court decisions that have not just gutted, but have given sanction to embedded racial inequality in the United States. I'll just take the one decision, the Williams decision coming out of Mississippi that I talk about in the book. In that Williams decision, the Mississippi Supreme Court said, okay, so it's really clear that the state legislature, recognizing that it can't just discriminate against the Negro. It just can't say, no, Negroes can't vote. But what it's going to do is identify the characteristics and then put those as the barriers to the right to vote. The U.S. Supreme Court looks at this and says, you know, the Mississippi Supreme Court said this, and the Mississippi Supreme Court is right. But we're going to allow the poll tax, because what those barriers were literacy. Because when you deny education, when you shut down schools, what you are doing is you are embedding illiteracy into a population. And what it also did was to deal with issues of poverty. So by linking literacy and poverty, boom, you have cut off the right to vote so intensely that by 1942 in the midterm election, only 3% of eligible voters in the poll tax states actually voted. That's the power of the poll tax.
And of course, there was an end around of the poll tax, certainly the literacy test more significantly. Can you talk to people about that, the grandfather clause as the end around for poor or illiterate, uneducated whites? Talk about the racial divide, right? This is sort of the schism. This is the plutocratic establishment insertion of this pitting of races against one another, the divide and conquer kind of technique.
What the grandfather clause did was it said that if your grandfather voted in the 1860 election, then you too were eligible to vote. Now, think about that.
Right. Let's think about it. Go ahead. Tell us.
That is that beautiful cloaked language. So you go, oh, okay. Who could not vote in 1860? There were 4 million enslaved black people in the United States in 1860.
That could not vote.
That could not vote. They were not seen and recognized as citizens of the United States. So what you have done with that language by saying, oh, by 1860, is to say, we don't want black people to vote. But you don't have to say that. You can just use that beautiful dog whistle language. And that, therefore, opens the door to poor whites. And let's be clear here, too. The way that this system works is that whites are collateral damage in white rage. And so you had a lot of poor whites who couldn't vote because they weren't the right kind of whites. And you had the registrar going, no, you can't vote. No, you can't vote. But there were some poor whites who could. It is the way that the system works. And I'm getting ready to hop forward to Lee Atwater's quote to make that point going backwards.
Indeed. Please do. That's a fantastic quote that you shared in your work.
Lee Atwater was the political strategist for Ronald Reagan. And after the Civil Rights Movement, they knew that they couldn't use the same kind of overtly racist language that had been used previously, say, by Theodore Bilbo out of Mississippi. And so Atwater says, you know, in 1954, you could say the N-word, 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 N-word. But by 1968, you can't. It hurts you. It backfires. So you use other words like forced busing, states' rights, and everything that you're talking about, there are these economic things like cutting taxes. But the point is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. Now, that's the key phrase there, that blacks get hurt worse than whites. So you have a policy mantra, a framework being set up that targets blacks, but understands that whites are going to get hurt and they're just acceptable collateral damage.
And you would bring that right up to the present with voter ID laws being placed in states all over the country. That blacks are hurt more than whites.
Yes, but, you know, so you think about, let's take Pennsylvania, right? Pennsylvania was one of those that immediately adopted voter suppression laws. Now, as they're adopting them, they made all kinds of promises. Yeah, we'll have some mobile ID spaces for the rural areas because, you know, you have Philadelphia on one side of the state and you got Pittsburgh on the other, and then you have a large rural area in the middle of the state. Well, the state didn't come up with enough mobile units so that people could get a government-issued photo ID. And people were going to have to drive for hours in order to try to get to a spot to get to a government-issued photo ID. But these places weren't always open. So the state sets up, yes, you have to have this, but then doesn't provide what is necessary. In the end, what the judge recognized was that, you know, you have basically set up a form of a poll tax here where you're requiring something that you're not providing. So you have all the middle of Pennsylvania is made up of a lot of whites, elderly whites, who can't be able to vote. That's what this voter suppression does.
Carol, let's look back historically at the post-World War I period, where over 1.5 million black traveled to the north for the jobs that were opening up in factories and plants up there.
Yes.
And in many cases, they were recruited. How did the Southern whites deal with that? What was the resistance? Tell us that story.
You know, when I was researching this, I found myself just going, oh, my gosh. The depth of the resistance to black people claiming their own destiny was intense. So one of the first things they did was, because it was very difficult for Southern white leaders to believe that black people weren't happy with Jim Crow.
Booker T. Washington obviously is a glaring example of the accommodationist school in that regard, and that was a mainstay in black intellectual thought at that period up through the early 20th century.
Right, right. You know, that whole Atlanta Compromise speech.
Indeed.
Well, And that just played into it. So when you had black people just moving, leaving because of the intrinsic, endemic poverty brought on by sharecropping, by the horrific lynchings that were happening, where there was no justice to be found anywhere. So you've got economic vulnerability, political vulnerability. Black people are leaving because what the war has done is it has created a need for labor in the northern industries.
So there's a push and a pull as far as the Great Migration goes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is like vintage immigration, vintage migration studies 101, right? Push-pull factors. And with that, the South at first said, no, we've got to have some outside agitators who are stirring up our black people, trying to lure them away. And so they start passing laws about labor agents, those who are recruiting African Americans to leave where they are to look for another job. And again, I say, in a capitalist economy, part of what we understand is you've got the right to look for another job, a job that's going to pay you well, not in the South. So they charged labor agents like a $1,000 license fee. In one city, they charged a $25,000 license fee. And again, this was like 1920. And if you didn't pay that fee, you could be jailed. And so it was a way to try to stop people from being able to get other jobs.
Slavery by another name.
Thank you. When that didn't work, when that didn't work because black people just kept on leaving, one of the things they went after then was the First Amendment. That First Amendment deals with freedom of the press. Well, the Chicago Defender had been one of the major papers helping to spur the Great Migration. It was a paper that was absolutely fearless. It talked about you need to leave the South. This is not a place for decent human beings to be.
Well, they stood up to Booker T. Washington fabulously.
Oh, didn't they? They stood up. My mother would tell the story of my grandfather, who would get his Chicago Defender folded under his arm, get a little swag on as he's walking away and saying, oh, I got my fender. It was a paper that showed that you were a person who respected yourself. And that paper not only encouraged African Americans to leave the South, but also talked about, look, we've got jobs, we've got housing, you know, this is how you can get out. It was an incredible paper. District after district in the South began to ban the Chicago Defender.
Well, and you had the Pittsburgh Courier. I mean, there were numerous papers, yeah, right, in these cities, yeah, and that's exactly right. There was an assault on the First Amendment.
A complete assault on the First Amendment, where you have a judge who is issuing an injunction against the sale and the distribution of the Chicago Defender. And let's be clear, there's not a libel law to be found here. Everything that the Chicago Defender was printing was accurate in terms of the lynchings, in terms of the laws, in terms of the sharecropping. So the assault is not that this is a scandalous paper, but in fact that it is a paper that is revealing the truth, so it must be silent.
In true muckraking fashion, you know, they're doing what the First Amendment and the free press is tasked to do as purportedly protected under our Constitution, and they certainly bravely did so. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. After this brief musical break, we'll return and continue our conversation with Carol Anderson. Please stay with us.
And I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times that I've fallen.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're talking about white rage, the unspoken truth of our racial divide. We are honored to be joined by historian Carol Anderson, who has written a fantastic history from the Civil War to the present about racial divide and the struggle particularly African Americans face against what she calls white rage. And earlier in the program, Carol Anderson described that term coming up after what had happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and also talks about what happened after the shooting of Amadou Diallo. We'll come up to the present by the end of the program. But before the break, we were in the 20s talking about the Great Migration. And, of course, there's a shift in African-American leadership at this time. We were talking about the importance of the press, the Chicago Defender, really kind of taking to task, as did the NAACP, a new organization at the time with W.B. Du Bois, and a new sort of cadre of leaders coming out of this period saying that the African-Americans, they shouldn't be accommodating the white power structure and that they should fight for the civil liberties that were theirs according to the Constitution. And so when you get through the 20s, it's a fairly tumultuous time. You've got the Booker T. Washington, the W.E.B. Du Bois divide. Then you have Marcus Garvey, Jamaican-born, coming in to the U.S. And the FBI is all over him, trying to undermine the efforts for early forms of what later are called black power and so forth. But could you talk to us a little bit about that decade, the Harlem Renaissance impact or effect, and maybe just take us through even parts of the Depression and World War II in terms of that concept of your book, The White Rage, and sort of the backlash to any form of African-American progress?
Oh, sure. One of the things I'll talk about is the Ossian Sweet case that I talked about in White Rage. And then I'll move briefly into the New Deal, and then have us come straight up and through the Brown decision. So with Ossian Sweet, this is also part of the Great Migration. He was originally from Florida. Eventually, he moves his way up into Detroit. He was a doctor, a physician. This is in the 1920s. And this is a man who should be the embodiment of the American dream, working his way up from abject poverty, going to school, going through med school, becoming a physician with a thriving practice. But the way that redlining and restrictive covenants worked, African Americans were moving into the North. You see an array of policies being designed to keep them trapped in these very isolated enclaves. And so in Detroit, you had in an area called Black Bottom, which is where black people were supposed to live. In Detroit, the area didn't expand, but because of the Great Migration, the population did by 10 times. So imagine 10 times the number of people living within the same small, confined area. It was also an area that somewhere between a quarter to a half of the homes did not have indoor plumbing. Again, 1920s Detroit in an area without indoor plumbing. Ossian Sweet says, man, I'm not living here. And so he tries to move to a white neighborhood. He and his wife move in. White neighbors are just like, no, we don't want black people here. And so they form a neighborhood association. They surround his house. They're throwing rocks. The police are there. The police aren't stopping the neighbors from getting ready to storm his house and God knows do whatever. And all of a sudden, shots ring out from the house as the neighbors are surging toward it. Two people are shot. One white man is killed. Ossian Sweet and his family, the people who were in the house, his family and friends, were arrested for murder. Now, according to Michigan law, this was self-defense. But according to the media, to the police, to the prosecutor, who would one day be a judge at Nuremberg, and to the liberal anti-Klan mayor, this was murder. A black person who was a physician had no right to self-defense. That's white rage.
And Tulsa.
Oh, my gosh, Tulsa, where you had Black Wall Street. You had African Americans who were working hard, again, doing everything that they're supposed to do. And the result was that they were slaughtered. to the point where you had an airplane flying over, dropping nitroglycerin bombs onto the black neighborhood. And, you know, and if you see the signs, you'll see one of the pictures from that moment saying, driving the Negroes out of Tulsa. We call that ethnic cleansing now. So it was an assault on black progress. When we get to the 1930s, we are in the Great Depression. Here you have African Americans somewhere between a 50 to 80%, depending on the region, unemployment rate. So we talk about a 25% unemployment rate across the nation. For African Americans, it was staggering. When New Deal legislation came through, because of the power of the Southern Democrats, and remember, the Southern Democrats have that power because of massive disfranchisement, because of literacy tests, understanding clauses, good character clauses, and the poll tax. It meant that these folks controlled Congress. They controlled the appropriations. And so whatever FDR was trying to push through, they're like, yeah, but it's got to be whites only. And so you have really disparate funding. You have really imbalanced so that whites received much more in relief payments than African Americans under the guise that black people didn't really need that much to live on anyway. You see that the way that Social Security is devised is that the occupations where African Americans worked the most were excluded from the Social Security system. You have the rise of the Federal Housing Administration that embeds in federal law redlining, so that the way that the FHA worked is that if you were black in a black neighborhood, you could not gain access to a Federal Housing Administration loan, which took the loan out over 30 years and was at a much lower interest rate. If you were black and moving into a white neighborhood, you did not have access to an FHA loan. Now, the FHA, to put this into perspective, helped create the wealth of the white middle class in the United States. But it is a major federal program from which African Americans were all but excluded. Because if you're black and you can't get a loan when you're buying in a black neighborhood, and if you're black and you can't get a loan when you're buying in a white neighborhood, that pretty much leaves you out of moving into most places and getting a loan.
That's still going on today, Carol Anderson, including in allegedly liberal areas like Marin County and with major banks, including Wells Fargo. I mean, we bring that story certainly up to the present. But before we get there, let's continue and let's go through the post-war, post-World War II era. There's a lot of changes taking place here.
There's a lot of changes. One of the changes I talk about in a talk I give called We Fight, and it is the insurgency coursing through the black community that's just like, you know, we fought Nazis. We're not coming back here to deal with Nazis. So a change has got to come to America. And so part of what I track, and again, let me be clear, I don't talk about it in this book as much, but after the Second World War, there is a wave of lynchings that happened, particularly against black veterans, because they were not in their place. They were not subservient. They believed that because they had fought for the United States of America, that they had a right to be treated as American citizens. And the response of the white communities, no, you do not. You have the right to be blowtorched and dismembered. You have the right to be gunned down next to your pregnant wife. You have the right to have your eyes gouged out. Just a series of horrific events happening immediately following the Second World War. And what is equally important, and I think has to be stressed, is that then you have a judicial system, a legal system, that says there's been no crime committed here. We can't find the perpetrator. And so you have this massive wound that allows this massive violence, and that white rage allows and gives sanction.
Or we find the perpetrators, like in Emmett Till, and they go free.
Yes, because you have a system that, in fact, sanctions this violence, that gives credibility, credence to this violence, that legitimizes the violence. And that's why, with white rage, I focus a lot on that structure, those policies, because if all we do is focus in on the Klan, then that means that all of this other activity, all of these other efforts that are requiring an enormous amount of energy, we just put our blinders on and we don't see, which was actually one of the big tricks after the civil rights movement. Let me take us to Brown.
Okay, before we go to Brown, Carol Anderson, we're going to have to take one more brief break.
Okay.
And this is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. We're having a fascinating conversation with Carol Anderson. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of the Racial Divide. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
We'll be home. We like the birds and the bees. We'd rather die on our feet than keep living on our knees. Say it loud. Say it loud. Say it loud. Say it loud. Say it loud.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson for the hour today. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We last left off before the break. We were getting into the civil rights period of Brown v. Board in 1954. And Carol Anderson, you wanted to continue from there.
Yes, and so here we have Brown, and Brown, the NAACP's initial framing of that was, okay, so Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. The states immediately ran to separate. They got that, my brother would say, with a quickness. That needed no explanation. They were separating all over the place, but it was the equal part. So they didn't even implement Plessy. They couldn't get to equal, and so you had wildly disparate funding and disparate accommodations and disparate quality of schools. In Mississippi, for instance, in Amity County, African Americans were funded at about $3 per capita and white students at about $30 per capita. That's disparate funding. And so as the NAACP first goes after disparate funding and the states really can't equalize the system, there's not enough money to do that. The federal government had estimated during World War II that it would take about, and this is in 2014 dollars, about $1.2 trillion to equalize the school systems in the United States. So when they can't get to that, then comes Brown. With that Brown decision, the South had already been gearing up its arsenal. And part of that arsenal was to shut down the public school systems altogether and then take public dollars. Now, they would talk about it in terms of their dollars, but African Americans paid taxes too. Take these public dollars and then provide tuition funding for all white segregated public academies, so that white students could continue their education while the public school system was shut down. This was most obvious and egregious in Prince Edward County, Virginia, where that school system was shut down for 5 years. White students continued to go through and get educated. Black students were not. And what we know with child development, that 5 years is a long time to be without schooling. You miss so much. and the way that the South just entrenched itself in terms of saying, look, as long as we can legislate, we can segregate. The Georgia Attorney General said, look, we know that a lot of the laws that we're passing are unconstitutional and that they're going to be overturned, but we're going to keep passing them. Because every time we do, it is going to take more and more time before we have to implement that U.S. Supreme Court decision. That is white rage. So here you have black children who want to get educated, who want to go to school. And the response is, we will shut down your schools. We will pass one unconstitutional law after the next to ensure that you do not get educated.
Carol Anderson, going from the civil rights movement forward, and certainly the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Economic Opportunity Act of 64, set federally some changes that were attempted to be implemented in many places and were strongly resisted by very angry white people. But the code words for affirmative action came out of that. And you very correctly talk about affirmative action as primarily just recruitment, a recruitment for jobs, or recruitment for schools, and essentially that's what it was. But for most white people, it meant preference, which was illegal, still is, always has been. But affirmative action meant preference for people of color, and that just brought out more white rage than ever.
Still does.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Mickey and I deal with this in the classroom all the time, and it's the mythology around that, you know, that like there was quota systems that had to be managed. You know, the only time that ever was a quota system was there was prior proven discrimination in a court order for, you know, a certain percentage, like one out of three hires. San Francisco Fire Department, certainly Lucky Stores here in California, a number of cases like that. But those were court-ordered things. It was illegal completely to have quota systems per se. But that became part of the mythology. And certainly the war on poverty manifested itself in a variety of ways with community action agencies at a local level, and in many cases empowering local black folks to engage in and be part of that process, challenging what had been an all-white welfare system in the country.
Yes.
And, you know, welfare, you know, the Social Security Act was for white women. And all of a sudden, there's a surge of black families going in under AFDC, so that had to be completely changed under the Clinton administration and eliminated, literally. So all of that has this history of countermanding any of the opportunities that were emerging at that time.
Absolutely. And you see this, for instance, in, let's take the vote. Right now, there's so much effort being put in to try to reinstitute the Voting Rights Act. So we get the Voting Rights Act in 65. The only way that act came through was to say that it had to be re-upped in 5 years, reapproved in 5 years by Congress. So in 1970, so we've got the Voting Rights Act in 65. By 1970, the act is coming up again, and the Nixon administration comes out against it. And comes out against it in that very subtle, cool way. You can't say, no, I don't want these black people to vote, because again, this is 1970. So what they say is that the act discriminates against the South. And that the act really isn't needed. It targets the South. That is just wrong. Now, the reason it was targeting the South is because the South had done so much in terms of denying black people access to the ballot box that it needed to be targeted. But the Voting Rights Act had enough flexibility as it went on that you had bail-ins and bailouts, so that all you had to do as a municipality or as a state or as a county was just stop discriminating. Quit trying to stop your people from voting. And you don't have to have federal oversight anymore. We understand this when we're so-called talking about criminals and parolees, right? But somehow when we have a state who 50 years after the Voting Rights Act is still trying to find ways to keep its citizens from having access to the ballot box, from having access into the say into their own government, somehow that state is the victim.
But it leads all the way up through the assault on Acorn.
Yes.
And the completely bogus nature of James O'Keefe and the attack on Acorn, and even though they were vindicated, their funding was gutted.
Acorn became the beard, as it were, the excuse to talk about rampant voter fraud.
Which wasn't rampant. It was. Election fraud is, but voter fraud is a different animal.
Let's be really clear here. This is some made-up stuff. It was when Greg Abbott down in Texas, who was then the attorney general, was trying to explain the rampant voter fraud in Texas before a judge, because right after Shelby County v. Holder, that horrific decision by the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act by taking out Section 4, by seeing Section 4 was unconstitutional, Greg Abbott says, hey, we've got rampant voter fraud. The judge says, show me. And he can point to two cases where somebody tried to use somebody else's identification to vote.
That's some outbreak.
I'm telling you, that is rampant, right?
Two.
So Texas had about 10 million votes. So out of 10 million votes, he has two cases. Now, the way that Texas has set up its government-issued photo ID required to vote, though, is that in many counties, there is no DMV. There's no place to get that government-issued photo ID. Some people have to drive for about 250 miles to get a government-issued photo ID. Many of those folks are black, brown, and poor, which means then, if you got to drive 250 miles to get a voter ID, you're talking about having access to a range of resources that aren't readily available to you.
And people glom on to these myths, these fictions, just like Reagan and the welfare queen myth, which, again, there are so many examples of this. You get a couple other books out of this. By the way, we're speaking with Carol Anderson, and her book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And we're running out of time, unfortunately. We're going to have you back on, but we have to get into a little bit of the so-called war on drugs here. And, you know, a recent piece in Harper's by Dan Baum, you know where I'm going with this, right?
I sure do.
John Ehrlichman, right, from the Nixon White House, basically is quoted as saying, the Nixon campaign in 68 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. Okay, right? This is where he's going. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities, arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. And I know some are questioning Ehrlichman in that regard as to whether or not he actually said this, but boy, does that certainly fit the pattern, Carol Anderson.
It so fits the pattern. I did a piece in Salon where I'm talking about Donald Trump, and why the GOP is angry with Trump is because he has pulled back the veil of white rage in the GOP, that use of policies as a means to undermine and undercut black advancement.
He sure has.
And that here, and I use that Ehrlichman quote because what that war on drugs did was to criminalize blackness in ways that then undermined and undercut the advances of the Civil Rights Act as well as the Voting Rights Act. Today, because of the ways that the drug laws have been used, from the disparate sentencing,
the mandatory minimums, the privatization of the prison industry, Gary Webb's blockbuster story on crack cocaine CIA in L.A., I mean, on and on.
On and on is that right now where we stand, according to the Sentencing Project, is we have about 2.2 million, I believe, African Americans who have been disfranchised because of felony convictions. The bulk of those are for nonviolent drug offending.
Well, that's what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's also important to see in this is that a study coming out of Duke shows that African Americans are one of the least likely racial and ethnic groups to use drugs. And another study out of the University of Washington, one of the least likely to sell drugs. So you've got the least likely being the most incarcerated.
Well, Carol Anderson, there are so many things in the book that we didn't get to and so many other historical parts of this significant narrative that you have in White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of a Racial Divide. Certainly didn't get to the 85 MOVE bombing in Philadelphia and, again, so many other things that have happened, including the rise of Black Lives Matter. But, Carol Anderson, we'd love to have you back on the program, and thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored show. Again, Carol Anderson, author most recently of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Carol Anderson, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored show.
And thank you so much.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for our program today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. We give special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
overwhelmingly, the statistics around murder, around emergency room admissions and the like is men's violence against others. And in intimate relationships, it's mostly men's violence against women and children. Certainly in same-sex relationships, domestic violence occurs at the same frequency as it does in heterosexual relationships. So again, it's a powerful person using their greater power, be it psychological or physical, to coerce somebody else to do something they want them to do. And I see that all the way from bullying in school, in elementary school, even in kindergarten and daycare centers, all the way up through the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, all the way up to the mass shooters. And when I say mass shooters, going back to thinking about the majority of these mass shootings are really domestic violence involved. Right. And they're not these big church shootings in Las Vegas that we see. They're more 4 to 5 or more family members who are being killed by a shooter.
A conversation on male violence, from the mass shootings in Texas and Las Vegas to what happens in the home. Our guest is Jeffrey Edelson. He is the Dean of School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. He specializes in working on domestic violence.
I think violent has, sadly, it pays. It pays off. There's a reward for being violent.
A reward for it.
I think there's a reward for being... Reward. Yeah, my experience in looking at domestic relationships where there's violence, in domestic violence, there's often... The violence is only part of a larger sort of coercive environment that the man or even a teenager in a dating relationship has introduced. So there's a lot of threats. There's a lot of coercion. In extreme cases, there are threats of, I'll kill you, or I'll kill myself. There are a lot of suicide threats, and that kind of coercion does pay off because people are fearful of it, and they then sort of follow through on whatever the coercing person wants them to do.
Jeffrey Edelson, next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Senate Republicans are preparing to unveil sweeping tax legislation that would usher in billions in cuts for corporations and the wealthy, repeal the federal deduction for state and local taxes, and likely compress personal income tax brackets from 7 to 4. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the middle class will benefit.
With this tax reform plan, the American people will know that relief is on the way for you and your family. We want to make taxes lower, simpler, and fairer.
Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Republicans have been crafting the bill in secret without allowing Democrats to participate. He said the Senate bill, like the one in the House, is grounded in tax cuts for corporations and the very wealthy.
A New York Times analysis found that next year, the House Republican plan would cause taxes to go up on one-third of middle-class families. By 2026, taxes would go up on nearly half of all middle-class families. And it hurts certain middle-class people much worse than others. People who have student loans, people who have high medical expenses, people who come from states where there are large property taxes, people who have big mortgages. These are middle-class people. They should not get a tax increase.
The Tax Writing House Ways and Means Committee planned to vote on its version of the legislation today, sending it to the full House. There is opposition by some Republicans in higher tax states whose constituents would suffer most from the loss of deductions for state and local taxes. But Republican Speaker Paul Ryan predicted the measure will clear the House.
Trust me, we're going to get this over the finish line. We're going to get this over the finish line because we need to get this done for American families. We need to get this done for people who will be helped by simpler, fairer taxes.
The ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee said the changes skew to the wealthy. Richard Neal said the measure will hurt the poor and middle class.
We're being asked to repeal the estate tax so that we can pay for getting rid of the tax that the sickest in America, the deduction that the sickest people in America take advantage of to pay their health care bills. Yesterday, one of them said, oh, so students can have $200 worth of interest deductions a year? There's $1 trillion worth of student debt in America. $1 trillion worth of student debt. Shaving back municipal tax exemption, gone.
The three richest people in the country now own more wealth than the bottom 50% of the U.S. population. That's according to a new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies. It's called Billionaire Bonanza. The report also finds the 400 richest individuals own more wealth than the bottom 64% of the population. Pervasive poverty means one in five households have zero or negative net worth. The report's authors write the U.S. is becoming a hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power. President Donald Trump sought to present a united front with Chinese President Xi Jinping following 2 days of meetings despite lingering differences over trade and North Korea. On trade, Trump said China had taken advantage of the U.S. in the past, but he doesn't blame the country for that.
And I have great respect for you for that because you're representing China. But it's too bad that past administrations allowed it to get so far out of kilter.
Trump said China must immediately address the unfair trade practices that drive what he called a shockingly large trade deficit, along with barriers to market access, forced technology transfers, and intellectual property theft. But to applause, Trump said, I give China great credit. During the presidential campaign, Trump accused China of raping the U.S. on trade. An environmental group and two Pennsylvania children have filed suit against the Trump administration to prevent the rollback of policies, programs, laws, and rules that address climate change and its consequences. Hausfeld, a global litigation firm, filed the suit on behalf of the Clean Air Council in Philadelphia and two children. The lawsuit challenges the administration's policies rolling back environmental protections, including pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, ending requirements that oil and gas companies report methane emissions, proposing the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, and more. The suit argues the Trump administration's actions will cause irreversible and catastrophic harm to the natural systems critical to plaintiffs' rights to life, liberty, and property. The suit also claims the administration is using junk science to wage a war on facts, data, and reliable principles and methods arising out of scientific, technical, and specialized knowledge. The suit claims one of the plaintiffs, a 7-year-old, is experiencing allergies, worsening asthma, anxiety about the future, and limited outdoor activities due to extreme weather brought on by climate change. A leading environmental group says California Governor Jerry Brown's reputation as a climate hero is undeserved. The Center for Biological Diversity traveled to the climate conference in Bonn, Germany, ahead of Brown's arrival there. It unveiled its report called Oil Stain. Jean Sue is the center's associate conservation director.
Jerry Brown will arrive here and has been lauded internationally as a climate hero and a climate crusader. And in fact, that is completely antithetical to what is happening in California right now. A true climate hero in California is someone who would actually be bold enough to take and tackle and phase out fossil fuel production. You cannot have a renewable energy policy while at the same time continue to also expand and encourage oil production in California.
Sue called for a ban on all fracking and an end to new oil development in California as the state pursues a renewable energy future. California is the nation's third largest oil producing state. The Center for Biological Diversity said much of that oil is highly carbon intensive. The United Nations and more than 20 aid groups are warning that the Saudi-led coalition's tightening of a blockade on war-torn Yemen could bring millions of people closer to starvation and death. United Nations humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock said unless the coalition lifts its blockade, Yemen will face the largest famine the world has seen in decades.
It will not be like the famine that we saw in South Sudan earlier in the year, where tens of thousands of people were affected. It will not be like the famine which cost 250,000 people their lives in Somalia in 2011. It will be the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims.
The Saudi-led coalition closed all ports and halted aid shipments after Yemen's Houthi rebels fired a ballistic missile over the weekend that was intercepted near Riyadh. The U.S. provides weapons to Saudi Arabia and in-air refueling for its warplanes carrying out bombing raids over Yemen. The California NAACP is asking state lawmakers to approve a resolution calling for replacement of the Star-Spangled Banner as the national anthem. The Sacramento Bee reports the NAACP calls the anthem one of the most racist, pro-slavery, anti-black songs in the American lexicon. Opponents of the anthem point to a passage they say glorifies the death of runaway slaves who fought with the British during the War of 1812. The anthem's author, Francis Scott Key, was a slave owner himself and fierce opponent of abolition. It wasn't immediately clear whether the California NAACP has found an author to carry its proposed legislation. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Chesrich. The statistics are overwhelming. The Department of Justice says that 90% of homicides in this country are committed by men, and 80% of people arrested for a violent crime are also men, and 97.5% of mass shootings are carried out by men as well. Well, today we want to have a conversation about men and violence. And joining me here in the studio for that conversation is Jeffrey Edelson. Jeffrey Edelson is the Dean of School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. He specializes in domestic violence, and we will be talking about that as well. And the connection to all these things from Texas and Vegas to what happens more at home. Jeffrey Edelson, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Mitch.
What do we know about men and violence?
Oh, well, a lot of the statistics you just read off, that men are the primary perpetrators of violence. They aren't the only, but they're the primary perpetrators. Ironically, men are the most likely victim of violence as well. So male-on-male violence is very frequent in our country. The violence, as you mentioned, we see it across the spectrum. So stranger to stranger, but a lot of it is domestic and people that know each other. We know from rape statistics that most women are raped by somebody that they know or an acquaintance or a current or former partner. We do know that mass shootings. So when four or more people are killed in a shooting, other than the shooter, the majority of those shootings are domestic related, and those happen almost daily in the United States.
Yeah, I think there's one per day on average.
Where there are four or more people killed.
And when we say mass shooting, we think about what happened over the weekend in Texas. Yeah. We think about what happened in Las Vegas. Yeah. But really, mass shootings, the Department of, or the federal government defines them as four or more people being shot, not counting the shooter.
Right.
And that usually is domestic violence.
Right. Most of those are families, family members, relatives, ex-girlfriends, current girlfriends, in-laws, children. Children are frequently killed in these shootings as well.
Do you see a connection if 26 people are are killed? I mean, obviously, that's a big mass shooting. Is there a connection between, say, when we talk about the lower level, the more common level, and one of the big ones that gets all the attention?
Well, I don't know specifics of the cases, like the Texas. I don't know a lot of detail about it. I don't think any of us yet know a lot of the
detail.
And that's
fair. I mean, some of this is speculation, obviously. Yeah.
Certainly, there are men who are generally violent towards their family members, but also towards others. And there are other men that really focus on family members, those who are more vulnerable and whom they can control with threats of violence. And often there's a long lead up, domestic homicides. The police have gone on average 5 to 7 times to that home on a 911 call before the murder occurs. So these are not unknown cases, just like the shooter in Texas. He was known to the military in depth. He was, in fact, incarcerated for a year, receiving treatment, escaped from the treatment facility at one point. And so these are people that are known to law enforcement and society, and we often don't take seriously the danger that they represent to others, and it's often too late when we discover how dangerous they are. Yeah.
And you work with people, and men. You work with men who have been violent domestically, and we'll get into that. Yeah. It's commonly said that domestic violence is a good indicator, a good predictor, or at least people who have carried out the mass shootings of many people that we put attention on, that domestic violence is almost always attached to that. Is that surprising to you?
I don't know if it's almost always, but that thread is there in many of these cases, even in the high school shootings by students. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have family violence in their homes. In a study in Cleveland and Cleveland suburbs, Mark Singer at Case Western University in Cleveland found that use of violence in schools was highly correlated to a child having been abused or witnessed violence in their own home. So there is a linkage, and there's research to show linkage even at school age violence between domestic experience of violence and then use of that violence, both towards ones they love as well as towards friends and strangers at school.
Let me ask you what we really want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
How do you respond if somebody just asks you, which I'll ask you now?
Yeah.
Why are men violent?
I think violent has, sadly, it pays. It pays off. There's a reward for being violent.
A reward for it.
I think there's a reward for being. Reward. Yeah. My experience in looking at domestic relationships where there's violence, in domestic violence, there's often the violence is only part of a larger sort of coercive environment that the man or even a teenager in a dating relationship has introduced. So there's a lot of threats. There's a lot of coercion. In extreme cases, there are threats of I'll kill you or I'll kill myself. There are a lot of suicide threats. And that kind of coercion does pay off because people are fearful of it, and they then sort of follow through on whatever the coercing person wants them to do.
So a social dynamic.
A social dynamic. It's really a power play, and that power pays off in coercion and I wouldn't say obedience, but the person who they're coercing following through on whatever the threat,
That's the reward.
Yeah, that's the reward.
They're going to get their way, however.
Yeah, they get their way. And you see that we were, thinking about Harvey Weinstein, thinking about all these sexual harassment cases. Again, these are powerful men who are using their power to coerce others, forcing themselves on others, raping women, sexually harassing them, and then following through with threats of undermining their career and following through on those threats. And women see that. And it's not just in the entertainment industry, but it's across our entire society that women who complain about sexual harassment often will lose their jobs. And we need to change that. And the Me Too campaign and everything that's happening in society, I'm very hopeful that that will change. But you know, that's just part of a continuum of men's use of coercion and followed through with threats and, in extreme cases, violence.
And that's important. Yeah. You see a connection between what we're seeing with women telling their stories about being sexually violent and sexual harassment to even mass shootings.
Absolutely. It's all part of a coercive control strategy that the more powerful men in these cases are using against women. Certainly, women and child abuse cases will use that same coercive of power against children and sometimes men if they feel that they can have that power over men. But overwhelmingly, the statistics around murder, around emergency room admissions and the like is men's violence against others. And in intimate relationships, it's mostly men's violence against women and children. Certainly in same-sex relationships, domestic violence occurs at the same frequency as it does in heterosexual relationships. So again, it's a powerful person using their greater power, be it psychological or physical, to coerce somebody else to do something they want them to do. And I see that all the way from bullying in school, in elementary school, even in kindergarten and daycare centers, all the way up through the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, all the way up to the mass shooters. And when I say mass shooters, going back to thinking about the majority of these mass shootings are really domestic violence involved. Right. And they're not these big church shootings in Las Vegas that we see. They're more 4 to 5 or more family members who are being killed by a shooter.
And you put all of our attention on mass shooters.
Yeah.
But that's extreme. It's not really where
extreme.
The big problem is.
Right.
And we put all our attention on Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
But it goes beyond Harvey Weinstein.
Absolutely.
It's not just Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby.
It's tens of thousands of men in powerful positions across our country.
Is it just that? Is it more than that? Is it men culture? How we're raised?
I do think we're raised. You know, when I'm driving with my wife, it's like I'm always certain where I'm going. She's willing to ask questions, ask people for directions. I'm the one that's always, no, I don't need to. I know where I'm going. And I do think there's a socialization of boys to be sort of in control, mm-hmm. to be certain, to not express fear and scared feelings and insecurity. In fact, when I work with men who batter, one of our exercises is to talk about how do you talk about feelings? Because most men and even boys, when they think of fear, insecurity, and the like, it's interpreted as I'm angry. And when I'm angry, I lash out. And there's a famous article about 20 years ago said, boys are warriors and girls are worriers. And I do think boys externalize. They point outward towards others. Girls turn it more in on themselves. And the research across a variety of experiences shows that boys do that. They turn against others. And so we see boys using aggressive behavior much more than girls. It's not exclusively boys. There are girls who are aggressive and violent. There are women who are violent towards their partners and children. But overwhelmingly, this is an issue for men and men's use of violence against others in our society.
Is it taught? Do we learn these behaviors?
I think, you know, certainly there's probably a biological origin of this. And if you look at chimpanzees and other groups of primates, you do see men being more aggressive.
Is it
and
testosterone?
Males being more aggressive. I don't know. I don't know the physiology that well. But one of the wonderful things about humans is that we have learned to control our behavior and use our minds to put our bodies to better uses, and we do have the ability through our minds and to control that behavior and to redirect it. And in fact, if you look at murder rates over the centuries, our societies are becoming much less violent than they have been in the past. The murder rates in Amsterdam and other cities in Europe in the 14, 1500s were much, much higher than they are right now in the U.S. Even though we're concerned about it and we always want to lower the murder rates, we are getting better, I think, as a species in terms of controlling our more innate desires to use violence. But, and I don't, you know, I would not excuse anybody for using violence just because it's genetic or something like that. Right. I think we have the ability to control. We may be provoked by somebody's behavior, but it's our choice in how we respond to that behavior. And that's what I try, a main message that I try to get across to men when I've worked with them in groups for men who have battered their girlfriends or partners, is that you may be provoked, but how you respond to that provocation is your choice.
Well, what do they say to you? I mean, I'm sure you get many responses, but is a common response, I can't control it?
No, I think a common response is that if she only did something X, Y, or Z differently, if she only had paid the bills on time, if she had only had dinner ready, if she had kept those kids under control, I wouldn't have had to beat her. And my response to that is, that's your choice, how you're responding to those difficult times. Every relationship and every family have very difficult situations that they're in, but it's your choice in how you respond to those difficult situations. And that's really about, in part, what you say to yourself, your cognitive self-talk, as well as how you then overtly behave towards others. And I think we, as humans, have an incredible capacity. That's where I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because I think we, as humans, have an incredible capacity to control and change both our thoughts and our behaviors.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that was about boys having a need to control.
Mm-hmm.
And one way that, whether it's a person, I mean, this is how governments enforce control as well, is is the threat of violence.
Yes. Yeah.
That's how you do it. I mean, governments do it.
I can remember when, I think it was even during the Reagan years, when there was a bombing in Libya by the government, and I was facilitating a group for men who batter at that point. We had to talk about what's the message that the president is giving about use of violence. We could certainly go there today. What is the message that President Trump is giving in this videotape that we saw and heard about his behavior towards women? I think there's a huge meta message out there. Maybe it's, you know, from leaders, and men interpret that. And I think, in a sense, President Trump's behavior in that videotape gave permission to a lot of people to do things that they might not otherwise have felt permission to do. So I do think our larger environment, and that's where leadership needs to give clear messages, our larger environment does influence individual behavior. And it's hard to be working on nonviolence and against sexual harassment when you have people at the leadership of the country behaving in exactly the opposite way.
He is not helping.
No, he's not helping. Not at all.
Do you think you'll see the results of this?
Oh, I think we already see it across the country in terms of men's behavior. I think we see it in terms of some of the people coming to campus in Charlottesville, the open bigotry that was exposed, that the marchers, the white nationalists, things that they were saying, they feel like they have permission to be open about their biases. And for a long time, I think we were working against those, and people were, maybe privately they held those beliefs, but they weren't saying them publicly and trying to recruit more people to their beliefs. And I do think absolutely the leadership that we have at all levels of our society does give clear message and permission for people to behave differently. I think that's a huge problem right now.
The high-profile mass shootings, in which dozens of people are usually shot, is also predominantly white men.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at mass shootings as a whole, going back to the government definition of four people or more, do you get the same dynamic?
I don't know the exact statistics, but I know that it's men, primarily men.
Primarily men, we know
and
that.
And if you look at the white homicide, men? I don't know if it's white men or not.
Okay, fair enough. We are in conversation with Jeffrey Edelson. Jeffrey Edelson is the Dean of School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley, and he specializes on domestic violence. Donald Trump, he was raised in this society as well. Mm-hmm. So he didn't come out of nowhere.
As was Bill Clinton.
And I think about this, and getting back to the point about Harvey Weinstein and what I said, but you know, he's a problem. Obviously, there are things that, you know, have to be addressed there. But but he's not the only problem. There are much bigger problems beyond these people. And it gets to this, and I've heard this term before, rape culture. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of time when people first time I heard rape culture, it might have been like the first time I heard the term white privilege. You know, my immediate response is like, oh, what's that? I don't get that. I don't understand that. But then you start to think about it, you start to dive in it, and you know, you're like, oh my goodness, yeah, I definitely do think we have a rape culture in this sense. I remember being a young man, and I remember among my friends, you did not want to be the last person to lose your virginity, right? Mm-hmm. That our view of our own manhood, of our own self within our group, you know, was influenced by our ability to attract women. We were told women play hard to get, right? They always say, no, you got to be persistent on it. We weren't told to rape what we understood rape to be at that time. But I think society has developed a new notion about what rape is today.
Yeah. I think our society has evolved, and our definitions of both domestic violence and rape and have been expanded. You know, rape is traditionally thought of as forced intercourse, but then we've added things like sexual harassment to the continuum. So we've started to see these behaviors in a larger continuum of behaviors. So the same with domestic violence. Stalking has been added to our laws. And so I think over time, as we've looked at issues like rape and domestic violence, we've expanded our definitions of what is included in these kinds of behaviors. So the same thing, sexual harassment to rape. There's a variety of domestic violence, stalking included.
There's going to be a party. There's going to be girls and alcohol, you know, is what we used to tell each other.
Yeah.
You know, and when I'm a young man, I'm talking maybe 20 years ago. Yeah. And this was seen okay, as being okay.
Yeah.
Well, at least it was by us. And I think by society as well, because you saw it in Hollywood films. Mm-hmm. You still hear it in music today and film.
Alcohol and violence, it's a good thing you brought that up. The research on alcohol and domestic violence in particular is that when I started in this field, if somebody was alcoholic or drug abusing, we would send them to treatment first and then say come back to the batter intervention program. We don't do that so much anymore. The research shows that indeed the use of substances or alcohol increases the frequency and the likelihood that you'll use violence, but those same men, when they're sober, are also violent. So it's not a one-to-one. Alcohol does not cause violence. And I've heard many men say, well, I was just very drunk. It is an uninhibitor, but it isn't the source of that violence. And those men,
oftentimes it is seen as the source.
It is often seen that way. Absolutely.
Drinking.
And many men have come to me in the groups that I've run and saying, well, you know, if I just stop drinking, I won't be violent. But actually the women, their women partners report, and the research supports them, that men are also violent when they're sober, those same men. They may increase the severity and the frequency of their use of violence, but the alcohol isn't necessarily the source of their violence.
Yeah.
It's more about this issue of power and coercive control. And the this term coercive control that I'm using is a relatively new term in the field. We used to talk about individual instances of violence, but Evan Stark and Marianne Dutton, two researchers on the East Coast, have over the last about 15 to 20 years started to talk about the idea that it's really a pattern of behavior that includes violent events. But again, this is the definitional piece where we've expanded our definition. It's really a pattern of coercive control that includes violence, includes threats, includes a lot of different things. And in fact, in the UK, they've redefined domestic violence to be more as a pattern of coercive control. And they actually prosecute people for coercive control, not just a single incident of domestic violence. Yeah. So that's a big change in our field and in legislation.
And that's interesting, too, to see the legislative things that are happening. Even Congress is taking up the issue, at least with sexual harassment on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
I just want to really make this point and then get your response to it. Because going back to the online Me Too sort of movement campaign, and women telling their stories about being harassed or sexually abused, it's basically every woman. I don't know a single woman who would say, no, that's never happened to me.
Yeah.
And if it's every woman, then it's almost every man that was a part. I mean, I don't want to say every single man, because I think there should be an ideal that we aspire towards, that we can achieve, but it's probably most men.
I'd say many. I don't know if it's most.
Yeah. Really?
And my experience is many of the perpetrators of violence are serial perpetrators. So in fact, that's how I got into this field. I was working in upstate New York. I was teaching at SUNY Albany. And the two shelters in town organized a meeting and said, we are seeing women who have the same perpetrator, multiple women coming to our shelter, and this one perpetrator is moving from family to family. I'd say it's many. I don't know if it's most. But one of the things that we do know is that early exposure to violence in your home raises the likelihood that you will be a perpetrator of violence. So it increases the likelihood 2 to 3 times that you're going to use violence in dating and intimate relationships.
Is that just because it's a behavior you're learning?
Yeah, social learning. It's being modeled for you at home. You're taking that as normal in many cases and thinking that that's just the way that I control my partner in an argument. Or when there's tension and I want something done, I use violence to accentuate my control over her, to reinforce that control. And I do want to say, though, even though it increases your likelihood 2 to 3 times of being a perpetrator, it doesn't mean that you're automatically, just because you've been exposed to violence as a child or been abused yourself. Most people, in fact, the majority of children grow up who have had that experience, grow up not to repeat that towards their partners. So it makes you at a higher risk, but it doesn't mean that the majority of children exposed to violence end up perpetrating that. And I think that's an important thing to think about, is why do those children who have those terrible experiences as children, how do they grow up to not repeat that? And I think what we talk about in the technical term is protective factors in their lives. And protective factors are often a caring mother who's protecting them from a violent perpetrator, a caring older sibling, aunts and uncles, your best friend's parents, and you're going to their house and you're seeing them behave a very different way. And that's the model that you try to live by later in your life. Often,
you have to do that consciously, though?
I don't know if it's consciously, but yeah. They do have these other protective people in their lives. They
other
have
models?
Aunt and uncle models. Teachers. Often young adults talk about a teacher that took them under their wings, and they had a great experience at school that was very different than what they were experiencing at home. So I am hopeful that there are protective factors. We need people to step up more. So in the field of sexual violence prevention, we talk about bystanders. people who know about what's going on but don't take any action. And I do think people first go to their family and friends, those people in their informal networks, before they seek formal help from police, social workers, and others. And I do think we have to reconsider our roles as family and friends and step up and both support victims, provide safety to them, as well as give clear messages to the perpetrators of violence that this is not okay. And in the whole discussion of Harvey Weinstein and others recently, we've all talked about, and we've heard about it in the news, that what did other people know? What did Harvey Weinstein's brother know about this, who was his partner in this business and settling all these cases? What did David Boies, who was an attorney on behalf of Weinstein, it was in the New York Times yesterday, what did he know about, and how did he facilitate the violence that was going on? So I do think we not only have to think about the perpetrators, but what's our role as a bystander to prevent violence and to give messages, clear messages of support to victims, survivors, and clear messages to the perpetrators that it's not okay and we won't tolerate it.
How do we do that?
I do think we call
it maybe a simple, I don't just
yeah,
do it.
But. Well, I think it's, again, back to culture. We call people on remarks about women's looks, about sexist remarks that they make at work, how they treat their employees. I think we have to call managers on that and people that are in powerful positions. And the case of Weinstein and others is that people didn't call them on it. I think Uber is another case that we've watched over the last year unravel because of behavior often by male superiors towards their female employees. We saw it at UC Berkeley last year. There were three very high-level cases of one dean, one vice chancellor, and a potentially future Nobel Prize winner. And we saw how they used their positions of power to intimidate and sexually abuse or sexually harass subordinates. And the university kept it quiet and punished them, but very lightly, and nobody even knew that there was a consequence for it. And then it came out last year in the news. And in part, there were consequences. I'm happy to say there were consequences for the administrators that allowed that. And we can't, as administrators and as supervisors and even as peers, we can't allow that behavior to go on, and we have to take a stand.
So it's in, we're different dynamics here. You have inside the home, what happens in the home, one growing up, what you model after. There's a society, your own community, and what happens there. I guess we already touched a little bit on society at large and talking about the role the president could play. Mm-hmm. What about film, movies, popular culture?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we model after that too, don't we?
We do model after that. Think of the movie Pretty Woman, where Richard Gere and I'm blanking on the actress's name. But
I would have had it if you weren't blanking on it. Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts, yeah.
Good.
Even though I grew up in North Hollywood, I'm not a big Hollywood buff. But, that was a prostitute. She's rescued by this powerful, wealthy man. And those kinds of images, and those repeat themselves in a lot of different TV shows, and it's not just prostitutes, but powerful men misbehaving, and then we get that message clearly. We see it in advertising, where they're using a sexy woman to advertise something totally unrelated to that woman.
Yeah.
So we see the promotion of women as sex objects, the promotion of sexualized behavior towards women. And I do think our advertising, as well as our movies and TV shows, do reinforce that.
And that's it kind of gets back to what I was saying, just how I remember how when I was a young man, these things, how they were being taught to us. But what about today? Are they still happening?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. What's still happening?
Just the way that roles, and I guess we're getting into roles, right? Male,
Oh, yeah.
Female roles, these roles that we have. And
it's being modeled all the time, and men behaving badly and getting away with it.
Yeah.
That's across our society, and that is being modeled every day in the workplace. It doesn't have to be in Hollywood. It's across all of our workplaces. You said, you know, most women in the Me Too hashtag, so many women have experienced it. So last year at Berkeley, when we had these sexual harassment cases, my female staff talked about their own experiences with sexual harassment. Almost all of them had some kind of experience during their careers of being sexually harassed. It is very pervasive. It's not an epidemic. It's the word we use is endemic. It's ongoing, high level in our society, across our society. And it's part of that cultural piece that we have to address the culture. And part of addressing the culture is us as bystanders not allowing our peers to get away with that behavior.
A lot of this reminds me of one of your colleagues at UC Berkeley that we've had on this radio program a few times, John Powell.
Yeah.
Who does a lot of important work for concerning implicit bias.
Absolutely. John's great.
Yeah. I mean, he opened up the world for me in so many ways in the conversations I've had with him over the years. And one of the things that he says is that it's like, racism is in the air. You breathe it. You're not aware of it, right? It's like, is a fish aware of the water that it's swimming in? And I imagine it's very much the same thing.
Absolutely.
Sexism, sexual harassment.
Yep. And again, it's usually people in more powerful positions abusing that power.
Is it just powerful? Because
I think it's it's a good
in this
question.
Dynamic,
it's a really
in this
good
dynamic,
question.
And culturally speaking, haven't men traditionally been in the powerful position?
Absolutely.
Regardless of...
Yeah. However, it's a really good question, because many of the men that I've worked with in domestic violence treatment groups, battery intervention programs is what we call them, many of those men feel very powerless. It's interesting, you know, this concept of power. Many of them have felt very powerless in their upbringing, in their current jobs. They're angry at their supervisors, and there's a lot of anger, and they bring that home and take it out on their partners. But in that intimate relationship, they're the more powerful one. So while they may feel at a larger level powerless, they are using their greater physical power against people that have less power in their lives. So the women in their lives and the children in their lives. And many of the men that I've worked with, while they're angry at their supervisors and they're feeling powerless at work, many of them will never express that towards their supervisors. That anger comes out towards people that are less powerful than them. So I see it as, you know, some people talk about, well, men are, they're losing control. I actually think domestic violence in particular, and sexual harassment as well, is a very controlled kind of behavior. They're not using it with everybody. They're using it against people that they know that they can coerce. So it serves a function for them, and it's very directed specifically. So I had a man in one of my groups on Monday afternoon. He tore up the living room, broke everything in the living room, and one of the other men in the group asked him, what about the television? And he had not touched the television.
He didn't touch the television.
Why is that Monday afternoon? Monday night football.
Yeah.
It was very functional. It was there to scare everybody in his home, but he didn't destroy the one thing that he cherished, which was to watch his Monday night football.
I've heard incidences of domestic violence reach their highest of any day of the year is during the Super Bowl.
I've heard that statistics. I don't know if it's an urban myth or not. Uh-huh. I just don't know. I don't know the data on that.
We are in conversation with Jeffrey Edelson. He is the dean of the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley, and we are talking about men and violence. You've indicated earlier that you're hopeful. Are you hopeful for societal change?
Absolutely. If you look again, I said a few minutes ago, over the centuries, murder rates have gone way down across our societies. I am very hopeful that people can make change. I'm a social worker, and I truly believe in rehabilitation. Some people disagree with me, but I do think when people are found guilty for sexual harassment or something like that, or domestic violence, that they should be given the opportunity for treatment, and they shouldn't necessarily be expelled from our society. By expelling them, we marginalize them and isolate them. And I think we have to engage them in change. And frankly, over my 40 years of doing this work, I have seen many people make tremendous changes in their lives. We're capable of doing that as human beings, and I'm very hopeful about the change. And I think these experiences, while they're horrible, what Harvey Weinstein and others have done, as they become more public, I'm hopeful that we as a society slowly bend the arc towards positive change and a more nurturing and less violent society.
How does that happen?
Uh-huh. Well, I think it happens really through civic action in big ways. The Me Too campaign is a great example. I think by raising the awareness, by showing how universal this experience is for many women, and then by changing how we interact with our peers, the values that we hold as a culture, and those values then get played out in the laws that we make. So, you know, the laws are really a reflection of our culture, and we need to implement cultural change at the macro level around media, how we interact with our families at the micro level, and in the intermediate area around how we legislate and what we define. Just as I said, you know, child abuse was just sexual abuse at one point. Then we added physical abuse. Then we added other forms of abuse. And so we need to expand our definitions of what is abusive and show that there are consequences for it. People will change their behavior if they know that there are consequences for it.
It really seems like this Me Too hashtag campaign has, mm-hmm. has opened up a space mm-hmm. right now and an opportunity right now. Right. But we're the ones that have to make the change, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, this has to be – men have to initiate this. And we're hearing from women. We're not hearing as much from men.
And the domestic violence movement for a long time has been considered a women's movement.
Yeah.
And I think women have led the way on it, and that's great. And I see myself as an ally, a male ally in that movement. I don't know that men have to take the leadership on it, but a lot of it is the source of it. We do have to change. Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying we have to take the leadership of it as well, but how do we make that happen?
Yeah.
How do we change as a society?
Yeah. Well, I think we stand up against the kinds of behaviors that lead to this kind of violence and harassment. And again, I come back to bystander. We all have a role in this. We all have a role to play when we hear a sexist comment, denigration of a woman, when women are talked over in a meeting and their ideas are ignored. There are all kinds. It's like the implicit bias that John Powell is talking about.
Yeah.
There's implicit sexism that happens every day in the workplace.
That's right.
And every day in our social interactions outside of the workplace.
And that's everyone.
That's everyone.
Talking about everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And we do have to change that. We have to become aware of it. Just like with implicit bias, we have to be alert to it. We have to be sensitized to it. And then we have to take action to remove it from our society.
There are people listening to this right now that are dealing with domestic violence right now. What would your message be to them as somebody who works with men who are domestic abusers?
My message to the men would be that you can change and that you can have nurturing, supportive relationships. And in fact, your life will be much better if you take the violence and anger out of it, if you work to really have a different perspective, say different things to yourself, and behave differently with the people around you. So I'm very hopeful. I've seen many men make change, so I'm hopeful about men and hopeful about making change. And I'd say to women that look for support, there are great programs in our communities, but also there are probably many people in your lives who can support you to be free of violence, to live a different life, and to have your children live in an environment free of violence. That may include that male partner. It may not. Most of the relationships I've seen do break up over time. But men, once they do change, can go on to have constructive relationships and good, positive, nurturing relationships if they make do the hard work to make that change.
And socially, getting back to social here again, if you want to say anything more about the individual, I'm happy to hear it because it could be helpful to anybody. But it just occurred to me when we compare sexism and racism, I think people today are much more likely to call out racism than sexism, than men are willing to call out sexism. We should approach sexism the same way we do racism. I'm not saying that we eliminated racism. Obviously, we haven't.
No.
But I much more frequently we'll hear somebody call someone else out for a racist comment than
I think we have to see those issues as in some ways related about people's power, privilege being used against those with less power and privilege, and we need to call it out, be it racism, be it sexism. And I think there's a lot of alliance that can be built in between those movements. They often are not necessarily allied, or the focus, sometimes we feel like, well, if we talk about one, we're pulling the focus off the other, and vice versa. But I do think that they're related in the big picture, and that we do, just like with implicit bias, we need to call out implicit sexism and eliminate it from our lives and our workplaces.
Are there any societies internationally that you know of that have taken a hard look at this, that do deal with this, that don't have?
Yeah.
I mean, there are obviously societies that don't have the level of violence that we have.
Yeah, certainly there are societies that don't have the gun violence that we have. And that's clear in Europe. You can see the number of murders with weapons is substantially lower than the U.S. I don't know that I can say, you know, I've worked all over the world. I've worked in Asia. I've worked in the Middle East. And sadly, I think the levels of domestic violence are similar across many of our societies. And we all have to do work. And the U.S. has done a lot of great work on domestic violence issues and men's use of violence, but we have a long way to go. And when we have models at the top of our society that are giving contrary messages, every day we have to push against that.
If it's similar across cultures, then does what does that say about the learning of how we learn about this? If you also see it similarly in other cultures?
Well, I think the way in which boys and girls are raised in a variety of cultures
are similar. Yeah.
You know, there are extremes and variation, and even within different religious groups, there are variations. But the messages are generally that, you know, a man's home is his castle and his kingdom.
That's what it comes down to, right? I'm the man. I am the boss. I am the king.
I had a man in one of my groups say, "This is God-given to me." And that was his rationale for being in charge and coercing the women and children in his life. And so, you know, I think that cuts across many different religions and many different cultures.
Yeah. Jeffrey Edelson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Again, Jeffrey Edelson has been our guest. He is the dean of the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. That does it for Letters in Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez, Abby Klinkenberg, and Lucille Rousseau. Our engineer is Kristen Thomas. If you'd like to find previous shows, you can go to our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Helena Norberg Hodge, Big Picture Activism. Local Futures, also known as Economics of Happiness, is an organization founded by Helena Norberg Hodge. They are pioneers of the new economy movement that is dedicated to the renewal of community, ecological health, and local economies worldwide. In July 2017, Helena Norberg Hodge spoke at Schumacher College in England. She began her Earth Talk by recalling the experience that changed her life, her visit to the remote region of Ladakh in northern India. Ladakh had escaped colonial domination until the late 1970s. In 1975, Helena Norberg Hodge found an almost intact traditional culture. But by the late 1980s, Ladakhi culture had been dramatically changed and many of their values destroyed, not by war or slavery, but by the introduction of globalized trade and consumerism. Here is Helena Norberg Hodge.
I had come out as part of a film team. I wasn't planning to stay for more than 6 weeks to help make a film. As a linguist, I'd been asked to both help with the sound of the film, but also to pick up a bit of the language. Well, in those 6 weeks, I just totally fell in love with the people. I had never, ever encountered people who seemed so vital, so full of joy. And so when the filming was finished, I stayed on, and I ended up doing research and doing a basic dictionary of English Ladakhi. The spoken Ladakhi was sort of a modern form of Tibetan, and that had not been written down before. I went through the whole region with these relatively small villages and one capital city. I never, ever saw any sign of hunger. I never heard people complain about being undeveloped or poor. In fact, people would say to me, oh, you must stay in the winter. That's the best time of the year, because then we just have festivals. You know, in the summer, you know, there's quite a lot of farming work. Now, I saw over a 10-year period how that incredible self-respect and their whole attitude to themselves changed because of what we call development. In came tourists, and in came ideas about a Western life that looked like it was a complete paradise. It looked like we do no work, because when tourists came to Ladakh in the early days, spending $100 a day was roughly the sum that a Ladakhi family might have in a year. In the early contrast between a culture where water, food, housing, medical care, basically everything you really needed was without money. So money was only for luxuries. And in fact, their money at that time was traditionally had been more in the form of stones, turquoise, coral, pearls, gold. And the women had most of that jewelry. But Western anthropologists were coming in, and I realized over the years that partly what they were doing, of course, was judging the culture by Western yardsticks, and they'd see that men and women sat separately at public functions, at weddings and so on. And that seemed to them like women, didn't have the same power as men do. It was also the men who went out and traded, who traveled much further away. The women tended not to go such long distances. But I would say, having grown up in Sweden, that in Ladakh, the status of women, the status of the feminine, was higher than in Sweden. In Sweden, probably out of the entire industrialized world, women and the feminine have a higher status. And I would still say that over the years, what I came to discover was that the structures, the whole way of life, made women and the feminine empowered that so much more. Now, it was a whole series of things. You know, one of them was that because they lived in intergenerational communities, every mother had roughly 10 caretakers for every baby. When you have that situation, if a child is ill or, you know, if there's a problem, no one gets tired or irritable or, you know, it's just, it's so easy. And that, of course, affects the child hugely. Now, I don't want to say this to make anyone feel bad or guilty for having grown up in or living in a typical Western context, but what I'm trying to promote is a vision of a more localized economic structure that could help us all regain many of the basic wealth of a culture like that. You know, we can't go back to living like the Ladakhis, but there are certain principles that are very important. And one of them is much more community contact and much more contact between generations. Also in Ladakh, when schools were brought in, which weren't there before, that when you put children age one in a room all day, you're creating a universe of competition and elbows. You cannot reach out a hand as a one-year-old and help the other child walk. You're physically incapable of that. Now, what happens, and I saw it out there, is that when children are mixed of different ages and with adults and in constant interaction, there's a natural process of learning and teaching that is lifelong. The modern-day schooling that we have was brought in together with industrial production and to train up a workforce. In Ladakh, it was so clear that when children had gone through schooling, they had been trained for a job in the urban sector. In other words, in a sector based on fossil fuels and materials which were not available in Ladakh. They learned nothing about food production, nothing about building a house, nothing about providing at all for basic needs. Later on, if they became specialized and went to agricultural college, then they would learn about a few pesticides and hybridized seeds and hybridized animals that were meant to be appropriate for Ladakh. And I saw how on the radio, you know, people were starting, the agricultural experts as part of development were promoting, among other things, DDT and other pesticides that were outlawed in the West. I also saw that with animals, the experts were bringing in Jersey cows. Now, in Ladakh, the grazing land was up at about 18,000 feet. I mean, you had to certainly go over passes of about 18,000 feet to get there. You had a very well-adapted cow and a mixture of the yak and the cow called a dzo that were able not only to go up to those high pastures, but they spent months, they were sort of semi-wild. It was lovely, lovely to see them because they really were their own masters. And then at the time of harvest, they would come wandering down. And sometimes they go off to another valley and you meet people who were running, you know, looking for their yak or their dzo. And they sometimes decided to come down too early and then they had to be escorted back up again. But bringing in Jersey cows, what did that mean? It meant bringing in industrial pellets, importing the pellets to feed them. And then, yes, they gave more liters a day than the typical local cow or yak, but nothing like the same nutritional quality of what these animals had from up. This is just one small example of what's happening with a monocultural development model based on fossil fuels, based on forms of production that are simply not compatible with the needs of the earth, with the biodiversity of the earth, and that are not compatible with different cultures. I just want to say something also about the psychological impact of the outside culture coming in, which came in through schooling, through radio. At first there wasn't television, and advertising, tourism, and development experts, most of them Indian, coming in. The message was, your culture is backward and primitive. You've got to do everything you can to become as Western as possible. And for the boys, the image was Rambo. It was so clear how these role models polarized and made a joke of gender roles. For the girls, it was literally Barbie doll. Blonde, blue-eyed Barbie dolls. And I saw women who previously had been strong and able to do things and respected for their abilities in the economy suddenly become so self-conscious and so passive. And I saw that depression, particularly among women, started coming in. I saw that with the young men, what started happening is that here they were being trained to be this modern Western man in this modern economy, and that meant earning money, and the jobs were very scarce. So almost overnight, by creating a scarcity of jobs, by creating unemployment, this modern economy created conflict and competition between people. So what emerged was a conflict between Buddhists and Muslims to start with. And it was clear that when you rob men of their self-respect as their identity to be who they are, and then you rob them of the ability to provide for themselves and their family, it's a recipe for violence. And it's a violence that will also mean turning against your own community, the women in your community, children in your community. It's just a terrible way to run a society, to run an economy. So what happened is literally that by 1989, there was violent bloodshed between Buddhists and Muslims. It was very traumatic. And I had already, before that, been so passionate about trying to say to people, wake up, wake up. This economic development model we have is simply not working for human needs. This tyranny of monocultural images affects all of us. I want to say that also as an invitation as to why I believe that big picture activism has this huge potential to bring us all together across racial divides, across cultural divides, across left and right politics, across, you know, grassroots to the top of business and government. We all, if we see the big picture, we will all have a reason to join in a systemic transformation of the economy. I have become convinced that we need to look at the way that our economic system goes back to a trajectory which really started with very big, wealthy business leaders. I mean, you know, it started with the kings and the rich sending traders off across the world. I mean, traders is not the right word. In the beginning, they were robbers. They were going to rob people of their wealth. And from having seen this economic transformation in Ladakh, and also later I worked in Bhutan between 84 and 89, and I saw exactly parallel changes to Ladakh. And again, people would say to us, this is our story too. The story you tell is what happened here. So it's very clear that we have not been aware of the fundamental structures of this economy and how it has its roots in colonialism and slavery. When traders were able to set up a situation where you had poor people over here and rich people over here, the global traders were able to amass more and more wealth and power. This process led to the birth of these giant corporations. Part of this system, too, is banking and what happened to banking and who has the right to make money. I'll come back to that. So this system really has continued unabated, but we haven't been paying attention to it, particularly in the last 30 years. So by the mid-80s, what had happened was we were no longer talking about the power of corporations. Basically, what we have seen in my network is that this process of trade treaties, which is really what globalization is, it's a process of agreements between countries and multinationals. And those multinationals are pressuring our governments to give them more and more freedom, the right to go in and out of national economies without any rules, without any constraints. And there are even clauses in the treaties now that say, if you do anything that might risk my making potential profit out of your country, I have the right to sue you. And so countries are signing in black and white, yes, you can sue us. So I just want to summarize by saying that I feel very optimistic now. You know, no guarantees or anything, but I feel very optimistic that it is totally possible that we will see a major wake-up to the central reason behind climate change, unemployment, and particularly those two are so important, because at the moment people are being led to believe that either it's their jobs or it's the environment. And they're voting for Trump and other leaders who are taking us in a disastrous direction. But behind unemployment, as well as climate change, as well as the extinction of species, as well as an epidemic of depression and anxiety, particularly among young people, the loss of democracy. And even if people don't see the loss of democracy, most of you will recognize that more and more governments are having a very difficult time creating a government. The instability and the swings are greater and greater throughout the world, in every country that I know of. Why? It goes back to the fact that the real government has become these businesses behind the scenes. Now, I am really seeing that everywhere you go, more people are waking up to that systemic root cause behind the instability, the poverty, the environmental problems. Beginning to see we must make an economic shift. We need rules. We need to regulate instead of deregulating. Now, the re-regulation is only going to happen through international collaboration. So in what we call big picture activism, we are talking about connecting with like-minded people as the number one thing. So we talk about connect, educate, resist, renew, and celebrate. And what we mean by connect is don't go at this alone. Try to find even one or two like-minded people near where you live. Try to meet regularly. If you can't meet them near where you live, then maybe connect with some of people on the internet who share your thinking and have some Skype meetings now and then. When you change the I to a we, you open up a very different avenue of thinking. You suddenly have more power. You suddenly are thinking differently. The next thing is to educate, and it starts by educating ourselves. There are so many layers of assumptions now. I mean, one of them has been that poor countries shouldn't need to lower their CO2 emissions. The rich countries should be lowering their CO2 emissions right now. It's a completely corporate agenda. The corporations, through globalization and trade treaties, were moving to where labor was cheap. They needed to have dirty, polluting factories in China, in Vietnam, in India. So to then have Western environmentalists campaign saying that poor countries shouldn't need to reduce their CO2 emissions, it's all been because of a lack of the big picture. If we understood globalization and the big picture, we would not be lobbying for the people in the poor countries to have more pollution and to have big factories where they have more or less slave-like conditions. We would be understanding that worldwide we would be better off strengthening local economies. shortening distances, and particularly around food. So the localizing part is what I call renewal. The resistance part is resisting the escalation of the juggernaut, resisting particularly the more trade treaties, and part of that resistance needs to lead to a political shift towards regulating global banks and corporations. Now, on the other side, the renewal is already happening all around the world. Everywhere you look, you will see the most inspiring and heartwarming changes that absolutely affirm that human beings are not greedy and aggressive by nature. For me, this is the most important message maybe that I have. Don't allow yourself to be told that, oh, the human race, you know, we're just like a cancer. We deserve to extinguish ourselves. I hear people saying that these days. Please don't fall into that trap. And please just look in at any little child you can see and know that all of us are born longing to be loved. And if we get that little bit of love, we're usually going to be quite loving people. And love is a very, very important driver. But the most important movement that I see worldwide that is so fundamental is the local food movement. And it is a global local food movement. But again, we've not been allowed to see it because it should be spelled out as the systemic and incredibly healing movement that it is. And we should be learning about all these initiatives around the world that are demonstrating that small, diversified farms are much more productive than large monocultures can ever be, ever. So structurally, we must move towards diversification, and it's happening around the world. They're proving that it's more productive, and it's more job-rich. So people have more meaningful work, and there's a whole new farmers' movement emerging, where young people are wanting to farm. They don't want to stand in a monoculture being told by a satellite and computer what to do, you know, bending over all day like a machine. That type of agriculture, which also grew up with a type of slave-like economic condition, and where even now we have migrant labor behaving like machines, that image is what is fed to us to make us think that, of course, we must have more and more technology to replace people. In actual fact, when you see what artisan production looks like, particularly in food and farming, but even in things like pottery, house building, many community localized small-scale forms of providing all our basic needs, are much more satisfying, use much less energy, are much less polluting. The only reason we can't do that is because of an economic system that's imprisoning us. You know, we need to see our way out of it. The shift in subsidies away from encouraging every business to use more energy and technology and dump people, that's what we're doing right now as a system worldwide. More energy, more technology. We subsidize that. We subsidize it from university, even in the schooling. That's what you're trained up for. If we shifted that to support really full employment and small-scale, flourishing economies for basic needs. Basically, we want to look at a world where society shapes business rather than business shaping society. Now, society shaping business means that you and I need to be informed about how money is made. Right now, it's a sham. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's absolutely criminal that a few financial institutions can make money out of thin air and then spin it around in this casino-like speculative system, you know, literally controlling the value of our currency, of our water, of our clothes, of our democracy, and of our ideas. if you learn about the incredible benefits of localizing, of renewing, of regenerating, restoring ecosystems, restoring the community fabric, mental health, there's so many wonderful, wonderful projects out there. So the final word is to celebrate. And that is to remind ourselves also in a whole embodied contemplative way. Allow ourselves to shut out the chattering mind that thinks about the climate change and Trump and all kinds of things that don't make us happy. To just allow ourselves to become calm and embodied and full of joy. Joy at everything that is still working so well. And it can just be reflecting on the miracle of the living world. So appreciating that beauty and that wholeness, that health, and how much is still working and beautiful is vitally important. And we urge in the celebration that we also bring back the sort of celebration that we had for our entire evolution until this modern, rather destructive economy. We used to be much more participatory. We developed many more skills. We were able to make things with our hands. We were able to do, some carpentry, some pottery. We had broad range of skills. And one of maybe the most important was singing, dancing, and making music. Very simple line dancing, Sufi dancing, the sort of thing that we did throughout our whole history. And that's incredibly enjoyable. So celebrate is a central part of rebuilding the local fabric, the participatory fabric, the local economy from the bottom up. And it really is an economics of happiness. Thank you.
That was Helena Norberg-Hodge. She spoke on July 26, 2017, at Schumacher College in England. Helena Norberg-Hodge is a pioneer of the New Economy Movement and recipient of the Right Livelihood Award. Her book, Ancient Futures, describes the Ladakh experience and has been translated into more than 35 languages. She is the producer of the award-winning documentary The Economics of Happiness and director of Local Futures. Thanks to Schumacher College for this recording. You can see the 50-minute video of this talk on YouTube. This college was inspired by E.F. Schumacher, the economist, environmentalist, and author of Small is Beautiful. Visit the website for Local Futures for dates of upcoming conferences and workshops. That's www.localfutures.org. You can find links on the website for this radio program, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. And you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
Curious, I'm Barry Vogel. Harper's Ferry National Park is located at the confluence of the Potomac River and the Shenandoah River in the easternmost corner of what is now West Virginia. This tiny national park, just over 1 square mile in size, is the location of the 1859 raid led by John Brown, a white abolitionist. Outraged by the sustained existence of slavery in the southern United States at that time, John Brown and his armed supporters snuck across the river at night attempting to take over the government arsenal and arm the nearby enslaved people and foment a revolution. Brown's intended efforts were ultimately unsuccessful and resulted in his conviction for treason and death by hanging. Nonetheless, he foreshadowed the growing discontent of slavery that would lead to the Civil War that began 3 years later. In this edition of Radio Curious, we join George Best, a national park ranger, on a tour of a portion of Harpers Ferry National Park and stories about its rich history. He tells his stories amid the background sounds of the rivers, railroads, and other machinery, and begins with a description of the foundry, the largest building in Harpers Ferry, with a 90-foot-high smokestack.
This is a massive factory. It will, on average, produce 10,000 weapons a year, for all just under 600,000 weapons in total during its lifetime. Behind you, these foundations. These are the two arsenal buildings where the weapons were stored. And where we are right now, this is called Arsenal Square. This is where the weapons would have been tested. Each weapon is supposed to be loaded with a double charge and fired to make sure it's not going to blow up in a soldier's face. So, as an armory worker, you have some incentive to do your work right. This is the complex that George Washington envisioned and eventually would be built here. Now, it's not all built overnight. It takes many years to build up to this. But even in its early days, during the War of 1812, for example, its first real test, our first major war after the Revolution, it averages that full 10,000 weapons a year. And it churns everything out. And these arsenals are empty, as they have just shipped out everything to supply our soldiers out in Ohio, Louisiana, and Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. These guns are going all over the place. Also, because of its close proximity to Washington, D.C., Harper's Ferry has a lot of weird stuff that the Springfield Armory in Massachusetts doesn't have, because we're close to all the congressmen and the patent office. So anything new that wants to be tested out, it happens here. Harper's Ferry is also producing rifles, which Springfield does not do until 1855. Harper's Ferry starts this in 1803. And also, Harper's Ferry will be the site of the first true example of interchangeable parts being produced in the world. In 1811, a man named John Hall, he's from Maine, he's tinkering around and he invents a way to produce truly interchangeable parts. Just in case we're not 100% clear on what this means, think about anything you use today. For example, a light bulb. That's a really good example. As long as you see the size of the socket, and you know exactly what kind of light bulb you need, you can go into Home Depot, Walmart, Lowe's, whatever, walk up, be like, I need this kind of light bulb. Oh, we got three different brands. Well, they're all going to fit. Screw it in. Bingo. Done. These are all interchangeable within the same model. Prior to this, no, not so much. You know, things may look very similar, and even to the naked eye, they may look exactly the same. Because they're being handmade, things are going to be ever so slightly off. So, for example, in weaponry, if, you know, you break a screw and you need a replacement, it's not going to fit perfectly. Also, if you and a buddy are cleaning your guns next to each other and you get your parts mixed up, oh, it's going to be a nightmare putting your guns back together because his screws aren't going to fit in your gun and vice versa. And trying to separate all those, really difficult. So, John Hall has invented a weapon, a rifle, that is completely interchangeable. It is all machine-made. Everything is exactly the same. 1813, it gets tested. And in 1819, the government doesn't just give him a contract. They hire him. They make him an assistant master armorer of Harper's Ferry. They build a whole separate factory down on what's called Virginius and Hall Islands. Starts out with just a few storage sheds, which he very quickly turns into a state-of-the-art factory. And by 1823, 1824, he is in full production. So that when the government comes to do an investigation to see, you know, are we getting our money's worth, he has 100 guns ready for Congress. He takes them all apart, mixes up all the parts, everything goes back together perfectly. No other country in the world has achieved this. They get close, And Eli Whitney, as I'm sure many of your textbooks in school said, invented this. He got really close, but it was all just very careful handwork. John Hall is the only one doing this 100% by machine. And this will revolutionize the very way we live. Over the next 20, 30 years, the American Industrial Revolution will be very focused around this idea of interchangeability and mass production and machines. Much more so than the great industrialized nations of Great Britain and France and what will eventually turn into Germany. They don't have this. And they start to realize this after a while. They start referring to this as the American system of manufacturing. And they want to know, how do they do it? What's their secret? So in the 1850s, the British, the largest, most powerful, richest, industrialized nation on Earth, wants to know what piddly-poo little Cousin Jonathan, that's what they called us, Cousin Jonathan, was doing across the pond there. They send a commission to the United States, and they go look at several large industrial cities. Among these are Pittsburgh, Chicago, and of course, Harper's Ferry. By this point, Harper's Ferry and Springfield, everything between the two factories is interchangeable. So you can have a gun made in Harper's Ferry, you march up north with it, you break a part off, and you can get a Springfield part put on, works perfectly. And they start sneaking around, trying to figure out, what are these guys doing? And they start hiring American workers. James Henry Burton, the master armorer here at Harper's Ferry, will take a nice, big, juicy paycheck to get on a ship and go to England and take over the Enfield Rifle Works in England, their largest producer of military weapons. But even then, by the Civil War, when we're importing large numbers of these Enfield rifles, they're still not interchangeable. The American ones are. And many of the soldiers who have Enfields start to grumble about it because the parts don't fit quite right. They want those Springfields over there that do fit quite right. And so this is kind of like, we are in space-age technology here in Harper's Ferry compared to much of the rest of the world. This is truly the heart of the American Industrial Revolution in this place. Now, there are a few fun stories on the sidelines here. We've got lots of labor issues that pop up. The biggest one involves alcohol. A lot of the armory workers in the early days, they were allowed to drink on the job. They would keep big jugs of whiskey on their work tables, and they would pound it down, and so long as they met their quota, didn't matter. They're getting the job done. We're good. Yes, you... drinking on the job while you're making firearms. Very smart. So, and of course, whiskey was the big drink at the time. And eventually this gets to be a bit of a problem, and they decide no more drinking in the armory buildings. And much to their surprise, there's no pushback from the workers. They thought there would be a strike. Nothing. They do notice, however, the workers are opening and closing the windows very frequently. And what was eventually discovered was, and there are different versions of how this goes. I'll go with the most common one we see. They had stuck hooks outside of the building, or laid it on the ground if they're on the first floor, big buckets of whiskey. And they would lean out with their cup, so they're technically outside with their cup. All right, close the window, back to work. And so they're drinking still, but they're not inside the armory buildings. They're out in the open air. So they found a way around the rule. And then, probably the most tragic and largest event to take place in Harper's Ferry, the big spark in Harper's Ferry's history, will take place with the armory in this little building right here. Now, I've described it was built in 1848, our newest building. Also, that cupola on top, that wasn't added until late 1859, early 1860, so take that off. This is the armory's fire engine house. It also has a little room for the night watchman. His job is to go around with a lantern and make sure kids don't play in the middle of the armory and there aren't any fires. And if there is a fire, there's a bell tower nearby. He can go out, ring that, sound the alarm. The fire brigade comes out, they put it out. Well, this will become more famous as John Brown's Fort. John Brown is a white man, born in 1800 in Torrington, Connecticut, and he will grow up an ardent abolitionist. Indeed, he will say in a story later in life that he vowed his life to abolition at age 12. That something happened that made him really an abolitionist. And he believed that he was one of God's instruments in making this happen. And religion was a very important driving force in his life. and it would guide him on this continued path of ardent, stern abolition. And so he will grow up, and regardless of what he did, he had many, many failed business practices. He was a very hard worker, had no sense of money whatsoever, was incredibly stubborn, and usually any discussions, whether they involved money or whatever, would always somehow turn to either religion or slavery. And so he rarely actually got many of his businesses going, and in many cases he cost himself and a lot of other people a lot of money. But he never gave up on the hope of ending slavery in the United States. He would build a little secret compartment in his barn in Pennsylvania to hide slaves on the Underground Railroad as they moved north to freedom in Canada. He never joined any abolitionist organizations, but he worked closely with many of them. But finally, by the 1850s, he declares war on slavery. Literal, with guns, war. He fights out in Kansas, becomes a household name for the Pottawatomie Massacre and the little fight on the Osawatomie Creek. And then he has a much grander plan. With a small band of men, he will sneak into Harper's Ferry, which one is in Virginia. At the time, there is no West Virginia. Virginia has the largest slave population in the United States. A little over 10% of all the slaves in the United States live in Virginia. In fact, Virginia has a surplus of slaves. Now, how awful does that sound? A surplus of human beings. And they are selling them to the deep south on the cotton plantations and getting very rich off of it. They're basically running a human baby factory. And, of course, we've got the Harper's Ferry Armory and Arsenal here. So, John Brown is thinking, large recruiting ground for an army that I can help the slaves fight for their own freedom. I can train them to be soldiers. Those who cannot fight, I can make a big highway in the mountains and take them up to Canada to freedom. Those who wish to fight can stay with me. I will arm them. And when we come into Harper's Ferry, this will be the great trumpet blow for freedom. He wants to take whatever weapons he can, sneak out of here, burn anything he can't carry with him so it can't be used against him. And that the mountains are the key. Hide up there. Dart out every so often. But if you have the high ground, you have a big advantage. And that is where he will hide. He sneaks into town October 16, 1859, with a mixed group of white and African Americans, 21 men. They will spread out throughout the town. They will take several prominent citizens hostage. But eventually, on this next morning on the 17th, the militia begin to turn out. Things start to go wrong. The first raider killed is right about where this fire hydrant is today. His name's Dangerfield Newby, a former slave. The first civilian casualty of the raid, in fact, the first casualty overall, is a free African-American named Hayward Shepherd. Shot because Brown had stopped the train, and he went out to investigate. But it was dark and rainy. He heard Brown's men yell, "Halt!" But none of the men with him, and Shepherd himself never heard that word before. And so they turned tail and ran. They saw strangers in the dark with guns. Those strangers in the dark opened fire. The only man killed is Hayward Shepherd, a free African-American, one of the people John Brown wants to help. And that will kind of set the tone for the rest of this. It goes very badly. By the end of the 16th, John Brown and his remaining men are crammed in this little building here. This is where he's forted himself up, thus John Brown's fort. He will knock a few holes in some of the walls so he can stick his guns out and shoot out at the militia. The militia charge forward a few times, but they're unable to get inside the building. They are able to rescue a few hostages from the watchman's room. That's really about it. Meanwhile, word has reached Washington, D.C. of what is happening here. And the only federal troops available are all 100 United States Marines. So they board trains with two cannons, and President James Buchanan finds the highest-ranking Army officer who is actually capable of moving. Winfield Scott was very old, weighed about 300 pounds, was arthritic, had gout, and so he was still very sharp in the head, but movement not so much. Also, keep in mind, when I say he's 300 pounds, also remember, the guy is 6'5", so he's a massive man. Also, if you ever find a picture of his horse, so we can't really send him out, even though he's a brilliant military commander, no. But the next highest-ranking man we have available as a colonel, home on leave just across the river in Arlington, Virginia, Robert E. Lee. So they snag him. And there's this little lieutenant named James Stewart, or Jeb Stewart, who's been harassing the patent office about this new saddle he's invented. They're like, "Yeah, why don't you go off with Lee? There'll be honor and glory out there." And so he attaches himself to Lee as an aide-de-camp. Lee will come here in charge of the Marines, take command of all the militia out here. So he's got about 1,000 men under his command. Brown has at most 10 men left. 10 of the Marines will stay across the river with the two cannon, then the other 90 will march into town. He will split them into three teams. Team 1, 12 men armed with sledgehammers to bash the doors down. Team 2, they're the next in line. They're the men with their muskets and bayonets at the ready for the assault. Team 3, everyone else, muskets and bayonets, ready to go fill in as Team 1 and Team 2 do their job. So Team 1 comes down. Lieutenant Israel Green, the actual commander of the Marine Company, charge down. They start bashing on the doors. Brown has reinforced them, and so the sledgehammers are unable to knock their way through. Team 2 comes forward, and they find a ladder. They'll pick this up and use it as a battering ram and bash against the door again and again. And finally, they break open part of the door and knock it partially off its hinge. They got a big enough hole they can fit through it. Lieutenant Green is the first man through, his sword drawn. Remarkably, not a single shot touches him. Next man through, Private Luke Quinn, an Irish immigrant, recently joined the Marine Corps. He is shot in the stomach and will be the only Marine to die. Next through is Major Russell, the Marine Corps paymaster, who's just along for the ride, with his wicker cane. He will go charging in, and then Matthew Rupert. Corporal Matthew Rupert will be shot in the jaw, but he will survive, probably minus a few teeth. And the rest of the Marines will come in. The fighting takes about 3 minutes. Brown is knocked unconscious by Lieutenant Green, and his remaining men are captured or killed. And Brown's raid, his hope for freedom, is over. He's taken over to Charlestown, Virginia, the county seat. He's put on trial, and he's found guilty of 3 things. Murder, treason, and inciting servile insurrection, or trying to start a slave rebellion. And for these, he is hanged on December 2nd, 1859. In his last message, John Brown will write on a piece of paper and give it to his jailer, and it reads, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away, but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that it could be done without much bloodshed." Of course, a year and a half later, we get the American Civil War. And it is that Civil War that will spell doom for Harper's Ferry in a major way. We're actually going to go out to the point where the two rivers meet and give you an idea of some of the destruction the Civil War caused to this place. You're going to follow me again?
We're listening to National Park Ranger George Best on a tour of Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, recorded on October 12, 2017. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
April 12, 1861. The first shots of the Civil War are fired. By the end of that week, the Harper's Ferry Armory will be gone. Confederate soldiers are advancing on it, attempting to seize it. They want those machines. There are over 10,000 weapons in storage in that building, in the arsenal buildings. They want those too, but those state-of-the-art machines are what they really want. The Confederacy is going to need those to make weapons for themselves so they can make their own independent country. To prevent this from happening, the badly outnumbered Union soldiers, there are about 50 of them, they will light the whole thing up and it'll go up in flames. Armory is gone. Now, the townspeople rush out and are able to save most of the machines, regardless of which way they lean politically. And this area is a little leaning slightly gray. Further west in Berkeley County is pretty blue. But they were more concerned about, if that goes up, that there goes my paycheck, there goes my way of taking care of my family. I need to save those machines. And so they're actually able to save about 80% of the machines. But Harper's Ferry is done for. Those machines are loaded up onto trains and sent to Richmond, Virginia, and Fayetteville, North Carolina. And Harper's Ferry goes from a bustling industrial town of 3,000 people, once the envy of Great Britain, to just being a ghost town of maybe 300 people. Its population has decreased by 90%. Buildings abandoned. This is where the railroad station would have been. There would have been hotels and restaurants here. This is downtown. This is the business district of Harper's Ferry. You notice there's not a whole lot left. February of 1862, Confederate snipers are hiding in these buildings, shooting Union troops across the way. The Union commander across the river, John Geary, has had enough. He marches his whole force across here. Well, I guess boats them across. They don't march through the river. And he burns all the buildings out here. So now there's nothing left. Eventually, the Union Army will fully occupy Harper's Ferry and make it a massive military base. They want to guard the railroads here. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which still runs today as part of CSX, that is the most important railroad in the entire Civil War. It is the main east-west line for the North, and the Confederates do a lot to try to disrupt that traffic when they can. So the troops here are actually nicknamed the Railroad Brigade because they are guarding the railroads. The town changes hands a total of 8 times. 80% of the war, though, it's in Union hands. And by 1864, they have transformed it again into an even larger supply depot. The armory buildings are cleaned up, re-roofed, they're turned into barracks, storage rooms, kitchens. They're turning out thousands of loaves of bread every day. Trains are coming and going constantly, soldiers marching through. Spies sneak into Harper's Ferry, too. And many of the major operations in the Shenandoah Valley will be based out of here in Harper's Ferry. So this place, it is now not just a city of 3,000 people, it is a city of tens of thousands of soldiers, depending on what time you're looking at. And it will be attacked again around Independence Day, 1864. Confederate soldiers are out on what's Schoolhouse Ridge, Bolivar Heights area, which does belong to the park. Union troops are up on Maryland Heights. During the night, both sides would sneak a few men into town to take some pot shots at each other. But one Confederate soldier hears rumors. There's a store in town, and it's got barrels of molasses. And you know what? That sounds pretty tasty, given that I've been eating green corn and bug-filled bread the last several years. And so the soldier sneaks into town. He's borrowed a mule and several buckets so he can get some of that very sweet molasses. A little flavor in life. And he knocks them open. He fills his buckets. And he ties them onto the mule. And then he just leaves them running so the Yankees have a nice big mess to clean up in the morning. And so he's leaving on his mule. And he gets just over the crest of Bolivar Heights. And the sun's coming up, so he's silhouetted. Union cannoneers up on Maryland Heights, they see him and go, you know what? Let's take a pot shot at him. Let him know we see him. Fire the cannon. Completely misses him, but it spooks the mule. Effing takes off and keeps running for miles. A few hours later, the soldier and his mule stroll back, rather sullen into camp, dripping in sticky molasses. His fellow Confederate soldiers are so desperate for something else besides what they're usually getting for food, they're going up to him with their hardtack, the bread that they've got, and wiping it off of him and the mule to eat. After the Confederates left, they came back into town, and their Union soldiers who complain about someone left a big sticky mess in one of the stores, and they had to clean it up. Now, once the war is over, Harper's Ferry has many, many, many deep scars. Many of these buildings are wrecks. They have holes in their walls. Some of them were completely torn down. This area was burned. The armory is gone. What is Harper's Ferry going to do? It tries to rebuild. Probably the most successful thing that will take place here is the establishment of Storer College in 1867, a place where anyone, regardless of race, gender, or creed, could get a higher level education. Although it traditionally was an African-American school. It was a place where former slaves and later on their descendants could go to receive an education. And it will graduate many, many students, the most prominent of which is probably Nnamdi Azikiwe, the first president of Nigeria. There's also Don Redman, the little giant of jazz. There's the Lovett family that would run the large hilltop house, the luxury resort of Harper's Ferry. Today it's kind of falling into the river. It is condemned. People do not stay there. There are plans to renovate it, though. It's been an ongoing process, so maybe someday the Hilltop House Hotel will once again open its doors. Storer College will close its doors in 1955, after segregation is outlawed. With segregation gone, the state of West Virginia figures, what is the point of African-American-only schools? They can go anywhere now. So they pull their funding, and the school, which was struggling financially already, has to close its doors. It has no money left. And so the buildings, many of them are torn down, but the few that are left now belong to the National Park Service. Two of them are where our headquarters are. Also, Mather Training Center today occupies Anthony Memorial Hall, the main campus building. It's still an educational facility. There are two training centers for the Park Service, for park rangers in the country. One is here in Harper's Ferry, the other in the Grand Canyon. And eventually, the park will become into being on paper in 1944. Its first buildings are acquired in the 1950s. And eventually, this will come to include the area where you're standing on, Most of the lower town district up here, a block up High Street and Potomac Street, it becomes private. Most of the Storer College campus and then surrounding battlefield lands. We have land up on Loudoun Heights, actually most of Loudoun Heights, most of Maryland Heights. We have Schoolhouse Ridge and Bolivar Heights, and recently we acquired the Allstatt Farm. All of it going to be preserved. So for future generations, for you all to learn something of the past.
George,
yes.
Could I ask you the questions I ask each guest at the end of each program, the three short questions?
Sure.
One of them is a eureka or an aha moment in your life that changed your life.
Yep.
When I first came here, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my history degree, just something with history. Came out here and realized, as just as on a whim, I took an internship out here, and I realized this is what I want to do. I want to be a park ranger. And I've been very fortunate in that. I've been a park ranger since 2011 now. I hope to keep being one until I can't work anymore. And that was the big eureka, I guess.
The next one is, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I just want to keep, you know, sharing the stories of our past with, you know, everyone else. You know, it's a very important part of who we are, and I want to keep doing that and find more of these stories to keep adding on to it and keep making the story more accurate, more real to, you know, the people I get to share them with.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I would say Dave Gilbert's Walker's Guide. It's a very good one. Goes through building by building, but you can read it in your living room just fine. Let's see, The Strange Story of Harper's Ferry by Joseph Barry. It's dated. You do have to keep your salt shaker handy while reading him. He embellishes a few things, but a lot of the really interesting and fun stories we get from Harper's Ferry, a lot of them we pull from that book. And then if you want to do more specific to the Civil War, I would say Harper's Ferry Under Fire by Dennis Fry, our chief historian here. That is an excellent one to get you the perspective on all of the Civil War stories that happened here.
Well, National Park Ranger George Best, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious on tour in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia.
No, thank you.
George Best is a National Park Ranger based at Harpers Ferry National Park, West Virginia. The books that George Best recommends are A Walker's Guide to Harpers Ferry, West Virginia by Dave Gilbert, and The Strange Story of Harper's Ferry by Joseph Barry. This program was recorded on October 12, 2017, at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. There are over 500 editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share as you wish. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.